This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents L.A. Times by Stuart Woods, performed by Tony Roberts. Vincente Michele Calabrese blinked in the sunlight as he emerged from the darkness of the York Theater. He sprinted for the subway and rode downtown toward his next movie, Woody Allen's Bananas. It was after midnight when Vinny left the 8th Street Playhouse and started home. Each step he took toward Little Italy was taken with more foreboding. He had cut school again, and he was already a grade behind. His mother would be waiting up for him, and his father, if he were home, well, he didn't want to think about that. Vinny was 14. Since the age of 6, he had been to the movies nearly 2,000 times. His friend and benefactor, an older boy named Tommy Provenzano, was always telling Vinny that he should keep his movie going a secret, because nobody would take him seriously. Vinny walked up the 5 flights. He inserted his key into the lock and slipped into the 4-room flat. "Bastard," a voice behind him said. Vinny spun around to find his father, Onofrio, sitting in a kitchen chair, a bottle of whiskey in his hand. Onofrio stood up, unbuckled his wide belt, and slipped it from his trousers. He swung the buckle at his son. Vinny ducked, and the heavy buckle passed over his head. Without thinking, he swung a fist at his father's head. The blow caught him solidly on the jaw. Vinny's father stared at him.
"You would raise a hand to your father?"
"I would beat the shit out of my father," Vinny said.
"Now I kill you with my hands," Onofrio said, rushing at his son.
Vinny was as tall as his father, but 50 pounds lighter. On his side, he had quickness, and tonight the fact that his father was drunk. He stepped aside and let Onofrio hit the opposite wall of the tiny kitchen. Then he stepped in and threw a hard left to the bigger man's right kidney. Onofrio sagged to his knees, groaning. Vinny went to work, hammering his father into unconsciousness. Much later, after he had helped his mother get his bleeding father onto the living room couch, Vinny lay awake and relived the pleasure of what he had done. He felt not the slightest guilt. Now he devoted himself to thinking about the worst possible thing he could do to his father. It did not take long to alight on the brown bag. Onofrio collected numbers money, then remitted it to Benedetto, a rising soldier in the Carlucci family. If Onofrio did not take the money to Benedetto, he would die for his greed. Vinny tiptoed next door to his parents' bedroom. He felt under the bed for the bag. He extracted the little satchel, then returned to his own room. There was nearly $3,000 in the bag. Vinny removed the floorboard that covered his hiding place. He placed the money in the hole. He took the brown bag and dropped it out the window into the air shaft, where he knew it would be found. By this time tomorrow, he thought, Onofrio Calabrese would be at the bottom of Sheepshead Bay. In 1989, Vinny Calabrese stood on the southeast corner of 2nd Avenue and St. Mark's Place in New York and watched the candy store across the street. The fat man was due any minute. Vinny felt neither guilt nor anxiety about what he was going to do. The only emotion he felt was impatience. He could see the marquee of the St. Mark's Theater in the next block, and he knew the Touch of Evil started in 8 minutes. The fat man parked his Cadillac and waddled into the candy store. Vinny crossed the street, strode past the magazine racks, and put his hand on the doorknob of the back room. He opened it very gently. The man looked up.
"Who the fuck are you?"
"I'm a friend of the guy who loaned you $4,000 9 weeks ago," Vinny said.
The fat man's fingers curled over the top of the desk drawer and yanked it open, but Vinny lifted a foot and kicked the drawer shut. A cracking sound was heard. The fat man screamed. Vinny opened the desk drawer and found a revolver. He tucked it into his belt. Vinny reached for the stack of bills on the desk and started counting.
"500, he said. My friend will apply this to the interest on your loan. On Friday, he'll want all the back interest. A week from Friday, he'll want the $5,000.
I can't raise $5,000 by then, the fat man whined.
I'll tell my friend you promised, Vinny said.
Vinny's beeper went off as he left the movie house. He grabbed a cab to Little Italy. He hurried into the La Boheme coffee house and stopped at a table outside the door of the back room. He waited for Cheech to press the button. Benedetto sat at a small desk. Vinny's old friend, Thomas Provenzano, now Benedetto's bagman and bookkeeper, sat at a table working at a calculator. Tommy Pro winked at Vinny.
Mr. B, Vinny said, I talked to the fat man. Was he nice?
He was nice for 500 after I broke his fingers. Benedetto laughed.
You're a smart boy, Vinny. You could go places if you could ever stop going to the movies.
Vinny nodded gratefully. Keeping Benedetto happy was Vinny's constant worry. There were corpses planted far and wide, men who had once displeased Mr. B. Not the least of them was Vinny's father, Onofrio Calabrese.
What is it with you in the movies, huh?
It's kind of a hobby, you know.
You're getting too old for hobbies. How old are you now, Vinny?
28, Mr. B.
Time you was making your bones.
Vinny didn't speak. Sweat broke out in the small of his back.
Maybe the fat man don't come through. You can make your bones on him.
Whatever you say, Mr. B, Vinny said.
Get out of here.
Vinny got out. He gave the cabbie an address in Chelsea. This thing about making his bones was beginning to weigh on him. Once he did that, he'd be a made man, a full member of the family. Benedetto would own him forever. Vinny ran up the steps of the Chelsea brownstone. As far as Benedetto knew, Vinny lived in his dead mother's place on Bleecker Street, but his real home was three rooms in Chelsea. He unlocked the mailbox labeled Michael Vincent. 3 years before, he had legally changed his name. After 2 years of filing tax returns, listing his occupation as freelance writer, he had obtained credit cards and charge accounts in his new name. He checked his answering machine.
Michael, darling, a woman's low voice said. Dinner is at 9. Try and be early.
Vinny got out of the black clothes he wore on his collection rounds. He selected a plaid tweed jacket and a pair of flannel trousers. He slipped into a cotton shirt and Italian loafers, and he was ready for class. He was seated in a classroom of the New York University Film School by the time the professor walked in. The class was on production budgets. Professor Waring held up a sheaf of papers.
Mr. Vincent, do you really think you can shoot this film for $2.6 million?
I believe I can, Rennie replied. Just because the piece is set in New York doesn't mean it has to be shot in New York. My budget is for an Atlanta shoot with some stock street footage of New York.
Across the room, a young man with curly red hair slapped his forehead.
And in what areas did you achieve savings by shooting in Atlanta? Waring asked.
Housing, transportation, sets,
Vinny said.
You're right, Mr. Vincent, Waring said. That's why you came in $800,000 under anybody else's budget. Congratulations.
After class, the red-headed young man approached Vinny.
I'm Chet Parrish, he said. Can I buy you a cup of coffee?
I've got 20 minutes, Vinny said, before I'm due somewhere.
The waitress put coffee on the table. Chuck Parrish pulled a script from a briefcase.
I'd like you to read this and cost it for me. It's a caper movie about some mafia guys who steal $2 million of their godfather's money and nearly get away with it.
Who's financing? Vinny asked.
I can raise $300,000, Parrish said.
You think that's enough?
Well, that's what I want you to tell me.
I'll read it and call you.
15 minutes later, a cab dropped Vinny at a pre-war apartment building on Fifth Avenue. He took the elevator to the top floor and opened a door with his key.
In here, darling, she called.
She was in bed. "We have half an hour before our guests arrive," she said, smiling. "Don't muss my makeup."
Vinny had met Barbara Mannering at a benefit for the NYU Film School 8 months before. He took her home, and they began making love in the elevator. We had been making love ever since, once or twice a week. She gave a dinner party twice a month. Vinny kissed a breast, unstuck his body from hers, and headed for the shower. When he came out of the bathroom, she was leafing through Chuck Parrish's script.
"What's this?"
"A guy in my budgeting class asked me to cost it for him. Who's coming for dinner?"
"Senator Harvey and his wife, Dick and Shirley Klerman, Leo and Amanda Goldman."
"Leo Goldman? Of Centurion Pictures?
I thought you'd like that."
"I'll be interested to meet him," Vinny said.
Everybody arrived almost at once. Vinny shook Goldman's hand, but made a point of not talking to him before dinner. It was not until after dinner that Vinny said more than two words to Goldman. Goldman initiated the exchange.
"I hear you're at NYU Film School," he said. He was a balding man in his mid-40s.
"Part-time," Vinny replied.
"What's your interest in film?"
"Production. It's where the control is."
Goldman laughed.
"Most people would say the director has control.
Producers hire and fire directors."
"You're a smart guy, Michael," Goldman said.
He fished a card from his pocket.
"When you got something you think is good, call me. That's the private number."
Vinny smiled.
"I'll call you when you least expect it."
Vinny spent an hour in bed with Barbara. When he had finally exhausted her, he took the Parrish script into the library. He read it in an hour, then got a legal pad and started breaking it down into scenes and locations. By daylight, he had a rough production schedule and budget. "What were you doing all night?" Barbara asked him over eggs and bacon.
"Reading Parrish's script. It is very, very good. And if it's properly produced, it can make money."
"Well, what do you need to produce it?"
$650,000, Vinny replied. "Parrish has already got $300,000.
"The project interests me," Barbara said. "I'll put up $200,000. You come up with the rest."
Vinny worked on the production budget for 2 days between collecting debts for Benedetto.
When he was ready, he went to see Tommy Pro. Tommy was 2 years older, but they had formed a friendship early. Tommy had gotten an accounting degree, passed a CPA exam, then gone to NYU Law School. "I'm going to make a movie, Tommy," Vinny said. "I want to see what you think." The two young men spent 3 hours listing contracts to be drawn and looking for holes in Vinny's business plan. There weren't many. When Vinny was about to leave, Tommy Pro said,
"I know a pretty good actress who's available. Remember Carol Giraldi?"
"Sure. I haven't seen anything of her for a while."
She's on the skids, a junkie. I think she could still work, and she's still got a name."
"How do you know about this?"
"I got a couple of pushers on the street. One of them's supplying her. She owes me $8,000. If you want her, pick up a tab and I'll make you a gift of her."
"I'll think about that, Tommy. And, thanks."
Vinny was as nervous as he ever got. Chuck Parrish was on his way over to the Chelsea apartment. Vinny jumped when the doorbell rang.
Chuck was accompanied by one of the most beautiful girls Vinny had ever seen.
"This is Vanessa Parks," Chuck said. "She's my girl and my leading lady."
"Great," Vinny said. He wanted her immediately.
"So," Chuck said, "what do you got for me? Can I do it for $300,000?
"No, you'll need $650,000.
"I can't raise the rest," Chuck said.
"I can,"
Vinny replied, "if I produce it."
"Oh, what have you produced?"
"Nothing," Vinny said. "But let me take you through the business plan I've worked out and show you how I'd do it." When he had finished, Vinny got up and fixed himself a drink.
Chuck and Vanessa whispered while he was gone. When he returned, Vanessa smiled at him, and he knew he was home free.
I like this, Chuck said. How do you know we can sell it to a studio when it's finished?
I have contacts. You're going to have to depend on my business judgment, though, when we do the deal.
Chuck stuck out a hand. You've got a deal, he said.
Vinny loved the work. He tried to get his collection business done in the mornings, then devoted his afternoons and evenings to mounting the production. There was one thorn in his flesh, the fat man. He had come up with the Vigorish on schedule and made two payments. Then, when Vinny stopped by the candy store to collect the next payment, he walked in and saw a cop. The fat man had called the cops. Benedetto was pissed off.
He needs getting dead, he said flatly.
Give me one more shot at him, Vinny said. After all, he won't pay you if he's dead. Later in the day, Vinny sat in a casting session and watched actors read for the three principal male roles. Vanessa Parks was reading with them, and Vinny didn't like what he heard. She had the makings of an actress, but she was too young for the part. He got up and went to a payphone.
Tommy, it's Vinny. I need some personnel. Somebody with some medical training and a knowledge of drugs. A little muscle wouldn't hurt.
I think I know what's in your mind, Vinny, Tommy said.
Roxanne. She's an RN.
Perfect, Vinny said. At 3 a.m., Vinny turned into an upper-middle-class street in Queens. He parked and got out. He approached the Cadillac, set the device on the ground under the gas tank, and activated it. He walked quickly back to his car and drove away. At the end of the block, he stopped. There was a whump sound as the detonator lit the gasoline, then a big fireball of an explosion. Vinny smiled to himself and drove back toward Manhattan. The son of a bitch would pay on time now. The following afternoon, Vinny met Roxanne. It's a short walk, he said. They came to a handsome brownstone on West 10th Street. Michael rang the bell and waited. She looked like hell when she came to the door.
Miss Giraldi, Vinny said. My name is Michael Vincent. I'm a film producer. There's a script I hope you'll read. A wonderful part. He handed her a brown envelope. I'd like to tell you about the project.
Well, the place is a mess, she said. But
thank you, Vinny said, brushing past her. Vinny told Giraldi about the film, about her part.
Well, Giraldi said, taking the script from the envelope, Downtown Nights. It's an interesting title.
Why don't you read the scenes now, Vinny suggested.
I'm sorry, but I don't have time right now. I'm expecting someone.
The man with the drugs is not coming, Vinny said.
I don't know what you're talking about. Who are you, anyway?
I'm a film producer, as I told you. I have bought your debt from your pusher. $8,000? That's a lot of drugs, Miss Giraldi. He was about to cut you off, anyway.
Look at me as a rescuing angel. You're going to supply me with drugs? She asked incredulously.
That's right, Miss Giraldi. And Roxanne here is going to administer them. Roxanne is moving in with you from this moment. She's going to maintain you through the weekend, the rehearsals, and the shoot. I don't want you to give her the slightest difficulty. Is that clear?
I understand, Giraldi said weakly. She turned to Roxanne. Now, please, she whimpered.
Vinny sat in the rehearsal hall and watched Chuck Parrish rehearse his cast. At noon, lunch was delivered, and Vinny took the opportunity to call Chuck aside.
Chuck, Vanessa is wrong for the part.
What the hell are you talking about?
Chuck demanded.
She's a promising actress, but she's too waspy. She's too delicate. She's too young. She's too green.
If I tell her that, she'll walk right out on me, Chuck said. Well, if she loves you, she won't, Vinny said smoothly.
Yeah, but we're too far along now. How can we recast the part in the time we've got?
I understand Carol Giraldi is available.
Well, can we afford her?
Yes. Chuck looked at Vanessa.
Oh, she's so goddamn beautiful, he said.
Your career is at stake here, Chuck. She can't carry the part, and they'll blame you for casting her.
You're right, Chuck said.
Vinny put a hand on Chuck's shoulder. Best to tell her now.
Well, just give me a minute, okay?
Sure, Vinny said. He walked downstairs and stood inside the door to the building, waiting. 5 minutes later, he heard a door slam, then the ring of high heels on the steel stairs. Then Vanessa nearly fell into his arms. She was weeping and nearly hysterical.
Vanessa, honey, take it easy.
The bastard fired me, she said.
Let's get out of here, Vinny said. Outside, he hailed a cab and bundled her into it. He gave the driver the address of the Chelsea apartment. In the apartment, Vinny mixed her a strong scotch. He pulled her onto the sofa and stroked her hair.
Listen, it's just a job, he said. You're going to have better parts than that. You have a rare talent that's going to propel you to a high place in the film business.
Do you really think so? She asked.
Absolutely. I'm going to create parts for you that will send you to the top of the business.
She kissed him. He kissed her back, but he held himself away. He wanted her to be the aggressor. She did not disappoint him. She pushed him back on the sofa, got his zipper undone. In a moment, she had him in her mouth. He felt himself swelling, then exploding. She kept sucking until he pulled her head away and swept her into the bedroom. Vinny made it back to the rehearsal before reading broke for the day.
How did it go? He asked Chuck.
Giraldi is absolutely wonderful, Chuck replied. She walked in here in 5 minutes. She was the part.
I'm glad you're happy.
I'm delirious. Did you see Vanessa?
No.
I dread seeing her when I get home, Chuck said. I feel just terrible about this.
Well, you'll get over it. And so will she, Vinny replied. An hour later, the phone rang in the apartment.
Michael, Chuck sobbed. She's gone.
It's how it had to be, Chuck, Vinny said. Get your head back into the film. Don't think about anything else.
You're right. The film is the important thing.
I'll see you in the morning.
Sure, Michael. Thanks.
Vinny hung up and looked toward the kitchen, where Vanessa was making pasta.
You like a lot of garlic? She asked.
Vinny sat straight up in bed. Something had awakened him. The noise came again, and this time he knew what it was.
His beeper.
He went to the living room phone. He dialed the number.
Yeah?
The voice of Cheech, the bodyguard, said.
It's me. I'll be there in 20 minutes.
Vinny didn't like being on the streets at this time of night. He opened a drawer, found the fat man's gun, then left the building. It took him only 5 minutes to find a cab. The streets of Little Italy were deserted.
You better get in there, Cheech said, indicating the back room.
Vinny knocked, then opened the door.
What's the problem, Mr. B? The fat man is trying to get me busted. He's been to the DA, who now has a warrant out for me.
Vinny was stunned.
I don't believe it, he said. Oh, the man can't be that crazy. Well, he is that crazy, Benedetto said. And it was your job on his car that pushed him over the edge.
He'd never testify against you, Mr. B, Vinny said.
They got him sequestered, Benedetto said. Except they found out where.
Mr. B, Vinny said, just tell me what you want me to do.
Make him dead.
He turned and looked at his bodyguard.
Give Vinny something heavy to make his bones with.
Vinny's mind went into a kind of crazy fast forward. He would try to get to the fat man, and the cops would kill him. But then again, maybe not. Maybe he would make his bones, and Benedetto would have him by the balls for the rest of his life. Cheech had a .45 automatic by the barrel, wiping it with an oily cloth. Decide, decide. Vinny decided. His hand went to the waist of his trousers and grasped the fat man's revolver. Vinny started up with the gun, saw the surprise in Benedetto's face. Vinny shot him in his surprise. The bullet went in under the left eye. Vinny knew he might not be dead, but Cheech was doing something with his hands. Vinny turned, crouched, and fired twice. The first one got Cheech on the left shoulder. The second hit him in the neck. He was having trouble getting a finger on the trigger through the cloth. Vinny quickly walked toward Cheech. He put one into Cheech's head. Benedetto was on his hands and knees, struggling toward him. Vinny shot him twice more in the top of the head. Vinny stood, frozen, in the middle of the room. Then a deep voice behind him shook him to his roots.
"Well, Vinny," Tommy Pro said, "you've really made a mess."
Vinny whipped around to find Tommy standing in the doorway, a sawed-off shotgun in his hands.
"Your piece looks empty," Tommy said.
He reached out and took the pistol from Vinny's hand.
"I was upstairs, working late. I'm glad it was you."
"You gonna give me to the Don, Tommy?" Vinny asked weakly.
"Are you insane?" Tommy Pro asked. "Look around here. You don't see the safe open. Even I don't have the combination to that safe."
Vinny began to recover. "You and me, Tommy? We take everything?"
"Not exactly, Vinny," Tommy Pro said. "You take half the money. I take everything else."
"What else?" Vinny asked, looking around the nearly empty room. Then he understood. Tommy went to the safe. He took two bank bags from a shelf and began to stuff money into both of them. Vinny took one of the bags.
"Go back to Chelsea," Tommy said.
Back in the apartment, Vinny got a knife and cut through the plastic bonding material that held four bricks in place. He stuffed the money bag into the hold and replaced the bricks. Vinny stayed away from the chute that day. They were still in Little Italy, and he didn't want to be seen there. Finally, he was unable to resist the temptation. He had a look at the money. It came to a little over $190,000. He could finish the picture now. Barbara Mannering ran a long fingernail down Vinny's chest to his pubic hair.
"Again, lover?" she asked sweetly.
"Barbara, you are insatiable, you know," she chuckled.
"I know that. I'll give you a minute. How's your movie coming?"
"We wrap next week. You know anybody at the New York Film Festival?"
"Sure. A girl I was at Bennington with is the executive director."
"Can you get it a look at the picture?"
I expect so."
Vinny held his breath and dialed the number.
"Mr. Goldman's office," a female voice said.
"Hello, this is Michael Vincent. May I speak to Leo, please?"
"Does he know you, Mr. Vincent?"
"How else would I have this number?" Michael said.
There was a very long wait, but finally the voice was male.
"Leo Goldman," he said briskly. "This is Michael Vincent. How are you?" "Oh, Barbara's friend. What can I do for you?"
"Will you be in New York for the film festival?"
"I'm there for the opening, then I have to go on to London. I've got a film showing the second night. Bring it to our screening room. 3 o'clock on opening day." "Oh, that's good. See you then." Goldman hung up.
Vinny exploded in laughter.
"A screening with Leo Goldman," he screamed.
Vinny was 10 minutes late for his appointment, and Goldman was waiting in the screening room. Leo Goldman sat hunched in a chair, cigar smoke rising from him. He nodded at Vinny, then pressed a button and said,
"Let's go, Jerry."
The film began to run. Goldman waited until the final credit had rolled before he spoke.
"Who owns this movie?"
he asked.
"I do." "I'll give you $2 million for it."
"No."
"All right. 2.25 million.
Vinny shook his head. Leo stood up.
"See you around, kid,"
he said and strode up the aisle. Vinny sat and waited for the projectionist to finish rewinding. He willed himself not to run after Goldman. Goldman came back.
"All right," he said. "Tell me what you want. Be reasonable, be realistic."
"I want $3 million cash," Vinny said. "I want a guarantee of a minimum of $8 million spent on promotion."
"I want you to come work in development for me."
"I don't want to develop. I want a production deal."
"What kind of a deal?"
$750,000 a year, 3-year contract."
"I like the way you do business, Michael."
Goldman rifled through his calendar.
"Let's see, I'm back from London on Saturday. You show up on the lot Monday morning, come to dinner on Tuesday."
By 7 in the evening, the contracts had been signed.
"Let me ask you something, Michael. What did it cost you for the negative?"
$630,000, Vinny replied. Goldman roared with laughter.
"I love it," he shouted. "I figured $1.8 million. I paid you more than you wanted." "It's always like this, kid. Two guys make a deal, they always know something the other doesn't."
"Leo, what do you know that I don't know?"
"Carol Giraldi died this morning. An overdose. That's going to guarantee $10 million worth of free publicity for this movie. I'm going to get her a posthumous Academy Award."
On the morning of the opening of the New York Film Festival, Vinny met Chuck.
"I ran the film last night and it looks great," Chuck said. "You haven't even seen it."
"I saw it yesterday afternoon with Leo Goldman of Centurion Pictures. He paid me $3 million for it."
Chuck's mouth fell open. He seemed unable to speak.
"Is that all right with you, Chuck?" Vinny asked.
"Well, I don't know. Is that a good deal?"
"It's a very good deal, Chuck."
Vinny produced an envelope. Chuck ripped it open. "That's a total of $747,000 and change," Vinny said. "Let me tell you how it breaks down. We spent $650,000 shooting the film. We got $3 million for it, leaving $2,350,000. Out of that, your fee for directing and writing was $150,000. My fee for producing was $250,000. Taxes are over $650,000, leaving a net of a little under $1.3 million to distribute to investors. Your share is 46%.
Chuck was looking at the checks and nodding. "Yes!" he shouted.
Vinny's second meeting took place later that morning. Vinny and Tommy Pro sat in a little office at the back of La Boheme. Vinny shoved a briefcase across the table.
"Your legal fees," he said.
Tommy Pro peeked inside, then closed the case and shoved it across the table.
"Completely unnecessary," he said.
"Tommy, you did the legal work. You made it possible for me to make the movie."
"I got a lot more than you did out of all this."
"How do you mean?"
Tommy shrugged.
"Look around you. Where are we sitting?"
"You're the new..."
"I am. And, if I say so myself, the family couldn't have done better. What's next for you, Vinny?"
"A lot of movies," Vinny replied. "I got a production deal at Centurion Pictures. I leave the day after tomorrow for L.A. By the way, from now on, I'm known as Michael Vincent."
That afternoon, he picked up Vanessa from a modeling job and took her to the plaza for tea. When they had been served, he handed her a slim book.
"What is it?"
she asked, leafing through it.
"It's a little-known novel called Pacific Afternoons,"
he said. It's going to be your first starring vehicle. Vinny took a sheaf of papers from his briefcase and handed it to her with a pen. You'll be under contract to me, personally, for 5 years, starting at $5,000 a week, with raises each year. She took the pen and signed the contract. Downtown Nights got a standing ovation at the film festival. The evening was marred only by Chuck's first sight of Vinny with Vanessa. The morning following, Vinny and Vanessa boarded an MGM Grand flight to Los Angeles. Vinny looked down at Lower Manhattan. "Goodbye, Vinny Calabrese," he whispered. "And hello, Michael Vincent." Michael approached the gates of Centurion Pictures slowly. A uniformed guard stepped out. "May I help you?"
"My name is Michael Vincent," he said.
"Oh, yes, Mr. Vincent," the guard said, smiling. He affixed a plastic sticker to the Porsche's windshield. "The executive building is at the other end of the grounds." Michael trotted up the front steps and entered the executive building. A receptionist smiled coolly at him. "May I help you?"
"My name is Michael Vincent," he said.
"Oh, yes," she interrupted. "I'll ring Mr. Goldman's secretary for you." Shortly, a plump woman in a business suit appeared.
"I'm Helen Gordon, Mr. Goldman's secretary. Mr. Goldman isn't in yet. He asked me to take care of you."
"How do you do?" Michael said.
"Mr. Goldman thought one of two offices might be to your liking," she said. "I'll show them to you."
She showed him a large office with a reception room of its own.
"The other office is really a little building of its own," she said. "It's only a short walk."
The room was large, with a very high ceiling.
"I think it's rather nice, don't you?" she asked.
"I do," he replied. "May I ask your advice? Which should I take?"
"Well," she said haltingly, "there is a body of opinion which holds that it's not wise to work too close to Mr. Goldman's office. He does rather have a tendency to look over one's shoulder."
"I see," Michael laughed. "Well, I think I'll be very happy in this building."
"Good," she said. "Now, let's see about getting you some furnishings. Follow me."
At a small door in what he assumed was a soundstage, she pressed a bell and waited.
"I'll introduce you to George Hathaway," she said.
"The art director?" Michael asked. "I'd assumed he was dead."
"He's very much alive, though he's sort of retired. He manages props and costumes now."
The door opened, and a tall, elderly man waved them in.
"Good morning, Mr. Hathaway. I'd like you to meet Michael Vincent, who's going to be producing on the lot."
"I'm an admirer of your work," Michael said. Hathaway beamed.
"How nice of you to say so."
"George," Helen Gordon said, "Mr. Vincent has decided to use the old screen test building. Do you think you could put together some furnishings for him?"
"Why, of course, Helen. I'd be delighted."
She left the building, and George beckoned for Michael to follow. He led the way to a vast warehouse of furniture and other objects. At the end of a row, Michael spotted something familiar.
"George, isn't that the fireplace from Randolph's study in The Great Randolph?"
"It is,"
George beamed.
"I always loved that room," Michael said. "When I was 12, I had this fantasy of living in it."
"Well, you know, that whole study is here, and I think it might fit the room. How would you like it if I reassembled it for you?"
"You could do that?"
"Mr. Goldman says you're to have whatever you want."
"Well, that would be absolutely wonderful, George."
"I'll get a crew on it right away," he said. "It should be ready for you tomorrow."
"Tomorrow? As soon as that?"
"Well, Michael," George Hathaway said, "this is Hollywood after all."
Michael left the warehouse and headed for his first meeting with Leo Goldman. Leo sat in a large leather chair. He waved Michael to one of the sofas.
"Your room's at the Bel Air, all right?"
"Perfect.
We enjoyed it, but we've already found an apartment in Century City.
Good. Fast work. Who's we?
My lady friend, Vanessa Parks.
Will we meet her tomorrow night at dinner?
You will.
Good. By the way, is there anybody special you'd like to meet?
Well, there are lots of people I'd like to meet.
Name somebody, Michael thought.
I'd like to meet Mark Adair. He had read that the novelist was in town. And I'd like to meet Robert Hart.
Well, at least you want to meet movie stars just like everybody else, Leo said, laughing. Bob Hart is just back from a month at Betty Ford's, he said. Booze, not drugs. He hasn't worked in over a year.
This is very kind of you, Leo, Michael said.
Not at all.
Leo leaned back.
What I want from you is a new picture next year, and then two pictures a year after that. I want good work on tight budgets. We've had a blockbuster or two around here, but that's not what pays the rent. We do it with good material, intelligently made. I've got a lunch, Leo said, looking at his watch. Come over to the house early tomorrow night. I want to hear about what you want to do next.
Fine. I'll look forward to it. Michael had a prearranged appointment downtown at 2:30. He checked the directory of a gleaming skyscraper and took the elevator to the top floor, to the offices of a discreet private bank. The Kensington Trust, the letters on the glass doors told him, was based in London. At the reception desk, he gave his name as Vincente Calabrese and asked for Derek Winfield. He was shown to a paneled office. Winfield rose to meet him.
How do you do, Mr. Winfield? Michael said. I expect you've been told of my banking needs.
Of course, Winfield replied. I understood from Mr. Provenzano that you had something in mind.
That's correct, Michael said. Here is a cashier's check on my New York bank for $660,000. I want to invest the entire amount on the street.
I see, Winfield said. What sort of a return were you anticipating?
Our friend said I could expect 3% a week.
I think we can manage that, Winfield replied. Michael arrived at his offices the following morning and was not surprised to find workmen in the place. Hollywood or not, he thought, nobody could put all this together in a day. The doors to his office had been replaced by a dark-stained oaken set. He passed through and stopped, staring. He was standing in the study from the great Randolph, complete in every detail. Michael turned to find George Hathaway standing there.
George, I'm overwhelmed by the room.
Michael set his briefcase on the desk and took out a copy of Pacific Afternoons. George, he said, handing him the book, I'd appreciate it if you'd read it.
I'd like to get your advice on how it might be designed for a film.
Of course, Michael. Glad to.
There was a knock on the door, and Helen Gordon appeared, followed by a tall, handsome woman who appeared to be in her early 40s.
Mr. Vincent, Helen said, I'd like you to meet Margot Gladstone. Mr. Goldman has suggested that Margot serve as your secretary. She's been with the studio for quite some time.
Perhaps Ms. Gladstone and I could have a talk, Michael said.
Of course,
Helen said. She took her leave.
Will you have a seat, Ms. Gladstone?
Thank you, she replied. And please, do call me Margot.
Michael sat down opposite her.
I'm puzzled about something, he said. Why am I, the new boy on the lot, being rewarded with such an elegant and no doubt accomplished assistant? Surely there are top studio executives who'd be very pleased to have you working for them.
Very well, she said. I don't see why you shouldn't know what everyone else on the lot already knows.
And what is that?
When Leo Goldman took over the studio, I became his secretary. We had an affair. It ended when he married. It became awkward having me around, so Leo passed me on to the studio's head of production, Martin Bell. We had an affair. This continued until quite recently, when his marriage ended and he married a girl in her 20s. She spread her hands.
So, you see, I'm awkward again. Nobody else wants me in his office. Everyone is afraid I'll report back to either Martin or Leo. I'm regarded as something of a political bombshell.
Didn't it occur to you to seek work at another studio?
I am 51 years old, she replied. I have 23 years vested in the studio pension plan, not to mention profit sharing. All that matures in 2 years. Then I can take my pension and my profits and my savings and do as I please.
Well, Margot, Michael said, I think I would be very lucky to have you spend those 2 years with me. Let's get to work.
Fine.
There's something you could do for me right away, he said. I want you to call every used bookstore in the Yellow Pages and buy every copy you can find of a novel called Pacific Afternoons. I'd like them by 4 o'clock.
Michael and Vanessa found the Bel Air house of Leo and Amanda Goldman on Stone Canyon. There was no imposing edifice, just a comfortable-looking exterior that only hinted at what must be a large place. Leo answered the door himself.
Come in, come in, he said.
Leo, Michael said, this is Vanessa Parks.
Welcome to our home, Leo said.
Amanda Goldman appeared.
Michael, she said, pecking his cheek rather close to the corner of his mouth. How nice to see you again, she turned to the younger woman. And you must be Vanessa.
Hello, Vanessa said shyly.
I know Michael and Leo have some talking to do, Amanda said to her, so I'll show you the garden.
Leo led Michael into a small study lined with books and pictures.
What's this about you cornering the market on some book?
You heard about that? Michael asked, surprised.
My girl, Helen, doesn't miss anything on the lot.
The book is the next project I want to do.
What is it?
Pacific Afternoons. It was written by a woman named Mildred Parsons.
I read it at Stanford, Leo said.
He got up and walked along a bookcase for a moment, then plucked out a slim, leather-bound volume and handed it to Michael.
You had it bound?
I liked it that much, Leo said. You think a movie could make money?
I do, Michael replied. If it's a quality production using the right people.
Leo sat up straight.
Now I know why you wanted Mark Adair and Bob Hart here tonight.
Michael nodded. Leo pondered this for a moment.
They're both perfect, but Hart will never do it.
What's the problem?
His wife. Susan's the one you'd have to sell, and she'll never buy it. Bob is 54 or 55, but Susan sees him the way he was 10 years ago, still making big-time thrillers, playing cops and cowboys.
Maybe he's ready for a change of pace, Michael said.
We're going to screen Downtown Nights after dinner, Leo said. My advice is give both Bob and Susan the book, then get her alone and try to sell her before she leaves. There's a different sell.
Try and challenge him in some way.
All right. And who do you want for the girl?
You met her a few minutes ago.
Leo gazed into his drink.
She's gorgeous, I'll grant you, but you're following your cock around.
No, Michael said. I'm not.
She's going to be startlingly good in this picture, Leo. She has it in her to be a very good actress.
Well,
I'm paying you for your judgment, Leo said. Just be sure you give me my money's worth. By the way, I suppose you've optioned the book?
The copyright expires in 3 weeks.
Absolutely not, Leo said. Optioned the book tomorrow. I'm not going to have articles in the trade saying how Centurion waited for expiration, then pounced.
All right, Michael said. They dined in a glassed-in room. Michael was seated between Amanda and Mark Adair.
I've greatly enjoyed your work over the years, Michael said to Adair when he had a chance. I'm putting something together right now, and it occurs to me that you might be the only writer I know who could do it justice.
Tell me about it, Adair said.
Do you remember a novel called Pacific Afternoons?
Adair nodded.
I read it as a teenager.
It was Mildred Parsons' only novel, Michael said. She committed suicide a year or so later. But what I want is for her book to be seen almost as it is read. It will take a very fine novelist to do that. The book was almost certainly autobiographical. I want someone to get inside her head and put that very real sentiment on the screen. Adair looked thoughtful.
I recall the book as conveying sentiment without sentimentality.
Then you already know what I want, Michael said. All that remains is for you to read the book again.
Well, I'll be glad to.
You'll have a copy before the evening is over, Michael said. When the screening was over, Leo leaned close to Michael and said,
I'll tackle Bob Hart. You take on Susan.
Michael found her in the hallway.
Susan, he said.
Leo is in there offering Bob a part. I'd like to talk with you about it. All right, she said. He handed her a copy of the book. There is a role in this book that will give Bob an opportunity to make his audience aware of a whole new dimension of his talent. The part I'd like Bob to play, Dr. Madden, will open up his career and make it possible for him to play virtually anything he wants. You have a great surprise coming. It's been a long time since I've been surprised, Michael.
The surprise is, when you've read the book, you'll know that everything I've said to you is understatement.
Michael arrived in his office to find his secretary holding her hand over the phone receiver.
There's somebody on the phone who will only identify himself as Tommy, Margot said.
It's okay, Michael replied, hurrying into his office. He picked up the phone.
Tommy!
So, how's it in Hollywood, kid?
You wouldn't believe how good, Michael said. When you coming to see me?
How about Saturday?
You serious?
I'm serious, kid. Where should I stay?
The Bel Air, and I'll take care of it.
How long are you going to be here?
Just until Monday. We'll have dinner Saturday, okay?
Sure, okay.
Give me a girl.
Sure, no problem. We'll meet you in the bar at the Bel Air at 7.
Look forward to it, Tommy said. He hung up.
Michael saw Margot standing in the doorway. It was an old friend from New York. He's coming in on Saturday.
Do you think you could find him a girl for the evening?
Somebody beautiful?
And make it somebody discreet. He's a married man.
Consider it done. By the way, you had a call from Mark Adair 10 minutes ago. Want me to get him for you?
Please. Michael waited for the call to go through. The phone buzzed.
Mark? Yes, Michael.
What do you think?
I think it'll make a brilliant film if you can get Bob Hart to play the doctor. Get him, and I'm yours.
Mark, I have to tell you, Leo's got me on a very tight budget.
How tight? The best I can do is $100,000. I want $250,000. I usually get $400,000.
Mark, I'll make it $150,000, but $50,000 is going to have to come out of my producer's fee.
Oh, shit. All right. Send me $50,000 and a contract. After you get a commitment from Bob Hart.
He slammed the phone down. Michael did a little dance around the room while Margot watched from the door.
Susan Hart called, Margot said.
Get her. He sat down and took some deep breaths. The phone buzzed.
Susan, I'm sorry to be so long. I was on the phone with Mark Adair.
Is he going to do it? She asked.
He certainly is. Well, what did you think?
Oh, I think it's interesting. When do you plan to start shooting?
April 1 in Carmel.
How much time in Carmel?
3 weeks.
God, I haven't been to Carmel in years. What kind of accommodations?
The best available, of course.
We'd want a suite at the inn.
Well, you mean you're considering this, Susan?
I'd better not find out you're lying about Mark Adair writing it.
Susan.
And Bob will want a million.
Susan, there isn't a million in the budget.
At half a million, Bob would be the highest paid cast member.
I'm only taking $100,000 for a fee.
I want a copy of the budget, she said. By noon today.
She hung up. Margot, he shouted.
Yes?
Print out a copy of the budget for Pacific Afternoons. I've got 750,000 in for the male lead and 300,000 for script. Change those figures to 500,000 and 100,000, then spread the money over the other categories.
Sure.
And Margot, find out who owns the copyright to Pacific Afternoons. Michael sat in the lawyer's office and stared at the man. He was in his mid-70s, Michael reckoned. A bottle of Scotch whiskey stood on his desk, a crystal glass beside it.
What can I do for you? The lawyer asked.
I am interested in acquiring the film rights to the novel Pacific Afternoons by Mildred Parsons. I understand that you, in some way, control those rights.
Indeed I do, Mr. Vincent. You see, Mildred's younger brother, Montague, was my closest friend.
Monty and I went to law school together.
And Montague Parsons controls the rights? Monty, alas, passed on last year. I am his executor.
Were there no other relatives surviving?
None. The rights to all of Mildred Parsons' works passed to Monty on her death. Those rights rest in his estate. The income from those rights passes as a bequest to Carlisle Junior College.
As executor, are you empowered to act for the estate?
I am so empowered.
Good. I'm in a position to offer you $5,000 for a one-year option. On exercising the option, I will pay a further $20,000.
Alas, no, Moriarty said. I cannot accept such an offer.
Well, what sort of price did you have in mind? Michael asked.
Oh, I didn't have anything in particular in mind, Moriarty said, replenishing his drink.
Mr. Moriarty, you must be aware that the copyright expires in 3 weeks. I can simply wait and have the rights for nothing. So if you expect to earn anything for your college, put down that glass and start doing business.
Ha-ha! Moriarty cried. So, you were operating under the premise of the life plus 50 years copyright law. Well, that doesn't apply here. The copyright to Miss Parsons' novel runs on the old copyright law, the one that was in effect when she died. I renewed the copyright 2 years ago, for another 20 years.
This is some sort of nightmare, Michael thought. Now, frankly, Mr. Moriarty, I'm speechless. Do you wish to sell these rights?
As a matter of fact, I would love to sell the rights, but I can't.
What?
I promised Monty Parsons when I became his executor that I would never, ever sell the film rights to Mildred's little novel. He hated films, you see. Thought they were common and vulgar. He would never allow his sister's only work to be corrupted.
Moriarty spread his hands.
I'm afraid, Mr. Vincent, that you'll have to wait until I've passed on. Then you can go to the trustees of Carlisle Junior College and make a deal with them. They didn't make any promises to Monty Parsons.
Michael stood up. Good day, Mr. Moriarty. Michael drove back to the studio in a fury, his mind racing. He had a top star and a top writer ready to work, and he didn't have the rights to the property. He walked through the waiting room, and Margot thrust a handful of pink message slips at him.
George Hathaway is here. Do you have a minute for him?
Sure.
George came into the room, a thick roll of heavy paper under his arm.
Michael, he beamed. I read the book and I loved it.
He unrolled the papers to reveal a sketch of the Northern California house of the protagonist of Pacific Afternoons. Michael stared at the sketch,
It's perfect, George. It is the cottage. Michael sat back in his chair. George, will you do this film with me? George turned pink.
My boy, I'd be honored.
He flipped through his sketches. It was all there. Every important scene in the book had been rendered.
You know which scene I loved the best?
George asked. Which one?
The one where the doctor sings to the young woman, Dein ist mein ganzes Herz, my whole heart is yours.
Yes, that is a wonderful scene. We'll have to cut it, though. I think the scene might be too much in conflict with Bob Hart's previous image in films.
Too bad. I love Franz Lehár.
Opera? Michael hazarded.
Operetta, George said. He wrote Dein ist mein ganzes Herz. Have you ever heard it?
Well, not for a long time, Michael lied.
Will you give me just 10 minutes more of your time?
Of course, George. George ran from the room, picked up Margot's phone, and made a call. 5 minutes later, two workmen appeared, pushing a grand piano on a dolly, and set it up. Then two elderly men walked in.
Mr. Vincent, George said formally, may I present Anton Gruber and Hermann Hecht?
How do you do? Michael said. Anton Gruber sat at the piano and played a soft introduction. Then Hermann Hecht began to sing. Michael had never heard the music before. It was old-fashioned, certainly, but the melody was wonderful. The old man sang it with such feeling that when he had finished, Michael had a lump in his throat. Gentlemen, that was wonderful, Michael said.
Now you can see why it's so important in the story, George said. The doctor finally expresses himself to the young woman in a song, in German yet, when before he couldn't tell her of his feelings.
You're right, George, Michael said. It could be the emotional high point of the film. It could be perfectly wonderful. If I can get Bob Hart to do it. Tommy opened the door and grabbed Michael in a bear hug.
Hello, Tommy, Michael said. I'd like you to meet Vanessa Parks.
How do you do, Vanessa? Tommy said.
I'd like you both to meet Mimi.
A small, dark-haired girl stood up from the sofa and shook both their hands. She was demurely dressed and very beautiful.
Now, where are we eating? Tommy asked.
I thought you might enjoy Spago, Michael said. Their table overlooked sunset and the big movie billboards. Vanessa stood up.
I'm for the little girl's room, she said. Join me, Mimi?
The women left. How is Maria? Michael asked.
She's okay. She likes being a capo's wife.
And how do you like being a capo?
My first taste of power, Tommy said. It's like fine wine. You can't get enough.
Say, Tommy, I'm having a little trouble getting the rights to this book that I want to make into a film.
Who's giving you a hard time?
Michael wrote down the name of Daniel J. Moriarty. He told Tommy about his conversation with the lawyer.
I'll look into it, Tommy said. Say, he said, that's some broad you got me. Is she gonna get mad if I want to fuck her?
She's yours for whatever you want, Michael said. Michael jerked awake to the sound of the telephone. He glanced at the clock. Just past 6 a.m. on Monday morning.
Hello,
he croaked.
Rise and shine, kid, Tommy's voice said. I just want you to know I'm taking care of that little problem of yours.
Thanks, Tommy.
Forget it. You know where the corner of Sunset and Camden is?
Sure.
Park your car there at 8 o'clock this morning, southeast corner. A guy'll pick you up.
Right.
Ciao.
Tommy hung up. Michael drove to Sunset and Camden. A large Cadillac pulled up next to him. A man in his early 20s, unshaven, looked at him.
Get in.
Michael got into the Cadillac.
Where are we going? He asked.
The driver held up a page torn from a phone book. The lawyer's name was circled.
To have a look at him.
Oh. The Cadillac swung into Bedford Drive.
That's his house right there,
the driver said. We'll wait. They sat there for half an hour. Then Michael looked up and saw Moriarty leaving his home. That's him, Michael said. Moriarty walked around an elderly Volvo station wagon, digging for his keys. The driver gunned the Cadillac. The Cadillac struck Moriarty, sending him up into the air.
Are you out of your fucking mind? Michael screamed.
The driver got out of the Cadillac and started walking back toward Moriarty, who was trying to pull his battered body across the street. Michael started to hip his way to the wheel and drive away. Then he saw there were no keys in the ignition. Indeed, there was no ignition. He looked across the street to where a man in a Mercedes had stopped and was looking first at Moriarty, then at Michael. Michael saw a middle-aged woman holding a newspaper looking straight at him. The driver kicked Moriarty over onto his back, plunged a knife into his chest, twisted it once, then walked back toward the Cadillac. He got into the car, reached onto the dash, did something with some wires, and the engine came to life. Michael was speechless with rage and fear. A couple of minutes later, he was left standing at his car. He could hear police cars in the distance. When he got to the studio an hour later, Michael's heart was still pounding. He slammed the door and walked into his office. He picked up the phone and called home.
What?
A sleepy Vanessa said. Vanessa, wake up and listen carefully. This is what you and I did this morning. We woke up early, made love, then took a shower together. I left the house about 9:30, later than usual, for the office. You got that?
If you say so.
Michael slammed down the phone. Where were his fingerprints on the Cadillac? On the door handle? Yes, and on the dashboard, where he braced himself. He tried to think, but couldn't. Finally, he buzzed Margot.
Find out who's the chairman of the Board of Trustees of Carlisle Junior College. Then make me an appointment as soon as possible. The chairman's name was Wallace Merton, and his office was in a downtown law firm. When Michael was announced, he drew a deep breath.
Good morning, Mr. Vincent. What can I do for you?
Merton asked. I'm a producer at Centurion Studios, and I am interested in the film rights to a property which has been left as a bequest to the college, the estate of Mildred Parsons.
Oh, yes. That man Moriarty.
I saw him last week, but frankly, I couldn't make much sense of what he had to say. I did understand that the Board of Trustees had it in its power to sell the rights.
Well, we didn't last week, only Moriarty did, but some hit-and-run driver ran him down in front of his house this morning.
Oh, I'm very sorry to hear it. If I'd known about this, I certainly would have waited a decent interval. But as long as I'm here, may I explain myself?
Go ahead.
What I have in mind, sir, is offering you $10,000 for a year's option against a $25,000 purchase price.
$25,000 against 50, Merton said.
20 against 40. That's as far as I can go.
Merton stood up and stuck out his hand.
Done. Send me a contract and a check.
Michael shook the man's hand. I'm sorry about Mr. Moriarty.
Drunken oaf, Merton said. He had a liver the size of a watermelon. I shouldn't think he'd have lived another month.
When Michael got back to his office, there were two men in his waiting room.
Mr. Vincent, these two gentlemen are police officers, Margot said.
I'm Sergeant Rivera, said the larger of the two men. This is Detective Hall. Are you acquainted with a lawyer named Daniel J. Moriarty?
Rivera asked.
I met the man once, and he was roaring drunk. I spoke with him about acquiring the film rights to a novel called Pacific Afternoons. Did Mr. Moriarty refuse to sell you those rights? He may have. It was hard to ascertain his meaning, given his condition. Mr. Vincent, can you tell me where you were between 8 and 9 o'clock this morning?
Michael didn't miss a beat.
I got up later than usual this morning. I didn't leave the house until around 9:30. Is there anyone who can corroborate that?
Yes. The woman I live with can tell you when I left the house. And her name?
Vanessa Parks. He gave them the phone number.
Do you know anyone who drives a red Cadillac? Rivera asked.
No. The policeman rose, then stopped at the office door.
There were two men in the Cadillac, Rivera said.
Any leads?
One or two. It was a professional job, we know that much.
Sounds interesting.
Tell you what, Sergeant, when you've made an arrest, give me a call and let's talk about it.
Might be a movie in it.
Maybe I'll do that, Mr. Vincent, Rivera said.
Don't wait until you're ready to go to trial, though. Call me the minute you've made an arrest before there's a lot of publicity, Michael smiled. I wouldn't want to get into a bidding war. The cop laughed and shook his hand.
Bidding war sounds good to me.
Michael waved and went back into his office. On the way home, Michael stopped his car at a phone booth and called a number Tommy Pro had given him.
A recorded voice answered. Please enter the number of a touch-tone phone where you can be reached at this hour. There was a series of beeps. Michael tapped in the number of the phone booth, then hung up and waited nervously. 10 minutes passed. Then the phone rang. He snatched up the receiver.
Tommy. Where are you calling from?
A phone booth on Pico.
How are you, kid? What's up?
Tommy, you very nearly got me hung up on a murder rap. What the hell were you thinking of? Tommy was immediately apologetic.
Listen, I'm sorry about that, kid. The guy was recommended to me highly. Who knew he was going to be a cowboy? Don't worry, he's already out of the picture.
Tommy, people saw me in that car with him. The cops have already been to my office.
Well, that's natural. After all, you had a meeting with the guy, right? Just be cool and everything will be okay.
Tommy, I don't know how you could put me in this position.
Tommy's voice hardened.
Your problem is solved, right?
Yes, but...
I gotta go.
Tommy hung up. Michael was left with the dead phone in his hand. Monday night at Morton's, the creme de la creme of the motion picture industry sat in the dimly lit restaurant. Michael and Vanessa sat with Leo and Amanda Goldman. After dinner, when the women had adjourned to the ladies' room, Leo leaned forward.
There's a guy I'd like you to consider to direct Pacific Afternoons, Leo said. His name is Marty White.
I appreciate the suggestion, Leo, Michael said, but I think I've already found a director.
Leo's eyebrows went up.
Who?
He's at UCLA Film School.
You hired a student to direct this movie?
Leo, I was a student at film school when I produced Downtown Nights.
Who's this kid?
His name is Elliot Rosen.
You'll love him.
The women returned to the table, and Amanda's foot ran down the back of Michael's calf. He gave her a brief smile.
Michael's intercom buzzed. Yes?
Michael, Margot said. Sergeant Rivera is here.
A trickle of fear ran down Michael's bowels.
Send him in,
he said, keeping his voice calm. Rivera was alone this time.
Thanks for seeing me, he said. I thought I'd bring you up to date on where we are on the Moriarty homicide.
Great. I'm all ears.
I haven't seen anything in the papers about it for a few weeks.
Tell me about it.
The car was driven by a low-grade hood from Vegas named Dominic Ippolito.
How'd you find that out?
Some hikers found Dominic dumped in the desert. His fingerprints were on file.
Did you find the car?
Dominic was in the car. It was down a ravine 400 or 500 feet.
Is that it?
Not quite. We found some other prints in the car that were interesting.
Tell me.
They belonged to somebody named Vincente Michael Calabrese.
He handed a folded sheet of paper to Michael. Michael found himself staring at his own birth certificate.
Who is he?
He managed to say.
He's the son of Onofrio and Martina Calabrese, and he's 28 years old, that's all I know. There is apparently no other piece of paper in the world on this guy. The only reason we know about him at all is that he had an arrest when he was 18 for car theft. That put him in the FBI fingerprint files.
So, what's your next move?
I don't have a next move, Rivero replied. Sergeant, I'll be frank with you. It doesn't look like we've got a movie here. This is all too incomplete.
I figured.
But if you ever come across another case that looks good, I want to hear from you. Michael had meant this to dismiss the policeman, but Rivera didn't move.
There's something I'd like to satisfy myself on, the policeman said. It's interesting that this Calabrese guy has two names that are similar to yours, Vincente and Michael.
An interesting coincidence, Michael said.
How old are you, Mr. Vincent?
30.
You have some paper that would document that?
Sure. Michael was ready for this. He rummaged through the personal file. Here, he said, handing the policeman a birth certificate. Rivera read it carefully.
You're 30, all right, and Calabrese was born at Bellevue Hospital, whereas you were born at St. Vincent's.
He looked up.
I see you're growing a beard.
I've had a beard off and on for years.
I wonder if you'd be willing to do a lineup for me.
Are you kidding? Michael said.
I saw a movie when I was a kid where a guy got picked out, even though he was innocent. Well, you're within your rights, Rivera said, standing up. I'll let you know if I come up with another case that might make a movie.
Yeah, you do that, Michael said. And Sergeant?
Yes?
Could I have my birth certificate back?
Oh, sorry, Rivera said. Just an oversight.
Some oversight, Michael thought, as he watched the homicide detective go. The certificate was real. Tommy Pro had seen to that years ago. But now Michael's fingerprints were on it. Margot came in with the mail.
Thanks.
He rummaged around his desktop.
What are you looking for?
She asked.
My letter opener.
You're always losing things. I'll find it while you're at lunch.
When Michael came back from lunch, the letter opener was on his desk. There was a brief knock on the door, and Margot showed in Robert and Susan Hart. Michael went to Susan first, giving her an affectionate hug. Then he shook Bob's hand warmly.
May I introduce Elliot Rosen, Michael said.
The young director shook both their hands.
Now, Michael said, tell me what you thought of the screenplay.
I just loved it, Hart said.
There are problems, Susan interjected.
I want to hear about every one of them, Michael said.
Susan Hart went through the screenplay, noting criticisms large and small. Nearly every one of them was aimed at increasing the size of her husband's part. Michael agreed with Susan on more than half the points and promised to consult with Mark Adair on the rest.
Finally, she said, the singing scene has to go.
Michael turned to her husband.
Bob, how do you feel about the scene?
I can do it, Hart said quietly.
But he won't, Susan said firmly. I won't allow him to do something that would shatter his image in the minds of his public.
Let me ask you, Susan, have you heard this piece of music?
No.
I want you to hear it right now, Michael said. He picked up the phone. Margot, please send in Anton and Hermann. Anton Gruber and Hermann Hecht entered the room. When Hermann had finished singing, everyone applauded. Then the musicians left.
I can sing it, Hart said. It's within my range.
I grant you it's beautiful, Susan said.
Tell you what, Susan. Let's shoot it,
then decide, Michael said.
All right, Susan said. We'll look at it on film, then decide.
Michael stood in the center of Leo Goldman's enormous office. 100 of the film industry's movers and shakers filled the room. They had all just seen the first screening of Downtown Nights, and there was nothing but praise in the air. Michael was receiving congratulations when Leo's secretary tugged at his elbow.
The security guard at the main gate is on the phone, she said. Apparently there's someone who claims he knows you trying to get onto the lot.
Michael went into the outer office to take the call.
Mr. Vincent, there's a man here named Parrish who wants to come to the screening.
Michael thought for a moment. Jim, give him directions to my office.
Michael hung up the phone and left the building. He walked quickly and arrived just in time to see Chuck Parrish climbing out of a battered sports car. "Come inside," Michael said. Michael gave him a drink and showed him to one of the sofas.
"Heard there was a screening of my movie tonight," Chuck said.
"I wish I'd known you were in town," Michael replied. "I'd have invited you.
What are you working on?"
"I've written another screenplay," Chuck said. He opened his briefcase and tossed Michael some bound pages. Michael looked at the cover. "Inside Straight."
Nice title.
"I want to sell it to you now."
"But I haven't read it yet."
"It's better than Downtown Nights," Chuck said. "You can trust me on that."
"But don't you think it's a little unfair to ask me to buy it, sight unseen?"
"I need the money, Michael."
Michael was stunned. "Chuck, last time I saw you, you had something like $750,000 in cash. What do you mean you need the money?"
"Well, there were a couple of bad investments and some slow ponies, and there was this very expensive lady. She and I picked up this little habit."
"Coke," Michael said.
I'm going into rehab. I just need to pay a few debts."
Michael flipped quickly through the screenplay. It looked well organized, and Chuck Parrish was a very talented writer.
"All right, Chuck. I'll give you $100,000 for it, sight unseen."
"I'll take it," Chuck said without hesitation. 2 hours later, Michael put down the screenplay. Chuck had been right. It was terrific. Inside Straight was going to be his next picture, right after Pacific Afternoons. He drove home feeling great.
Michael got to the office early and began working up Chuck's contract. Then he called Leo Goldman.
"How's Pacific Afternoons going?" Leo asked.
"Extremely well."
"Well, let me give you a tip about the Hearts. Bob's been through a couple of drying out programs, but as soon as he's faced with a role that scares him, he's back on the bottle. His particular weakness is French wines. The man had the largest collection of 1961 Red Bordeaux in the United States. Susan made him sell his cellar. I bought some of them myself. The man is helpless in the presence of a Mouton Rothschild."
"I'll keep it in mind," Michael said.
He certainly would. "Any idea what you'll do after you wrap Pacific Afternoons?" Leo asked.
"I bought a script. It's called Inside Straight, and it's about a friendly weekly poker game where three of the players conspire to take one of the others for everything."
"Who wrote it?"
"Chuck Parrish."
"What did you pay?"
$200,000.
"Great.
One thing, Leo, Chuck is in some sort of a bind and wants his money in cash."
"I'll call accounting and get your check out. I'll call the bank, too, and tell them you'll want it in cash."
"Tell them we'd like a private room for the transaction," Michael said. Michael was at the bank at 11:30 with his own briefcase and a cheap plastic one. He sought out the branch manager.
Ask your people to put $100,000 into each one," he said. "I'm expecting a Mr. Parrish, and I'll give you the endorsed check as soon as he arrives."
Chuck arrived and was shown to the conference room. "Did you bring the money?" he asked.
"I've got the check right here. You'll have to endorse it."
He turned the check face down on the conference table and gave Chuck a pen. Chuck hurriedly signed the check.
"I'll be right back," Michael said.
He left the room and took the check to the manager. The manager handed over the two briefcases. Michael returned to the conference room with both cases. He placed his on the floor beside the table, then put the plastic one on the tabletop.
"I want you to count it," he said to Chuck.
Chuck shuffled briefly through the money.
"It looks okay to me."
"Chuck, before you go, there's something you better understand."
"Yeah?"
"The contract states the amount is $200,000. For all practical purposes, I have just given you, and you have just received, $200,000.
"I don't understand."
"Don't worry. It'll help you get your price up in this town."
"Michael, are you stealing money from me?"
"Chuck, if you're unhappy in any way, I'll give you back your contract and we'll call it a day."
"I'm happy, Michael," Chuck said.
"Who else would give me $100,000 for a screenplay you hadn't even read?"
Chuck shook his hand
and left. Michael drove downtown to his own bank, the Kensington Trust. Derek Winfield received him in his office. "I'd like to make a deposit," Michael said.
"Of course," Winfield replied.
Michael left Winfield's office whistling. It was difficult to know how things could be any better. Special Agent Thomas Carson of the Los Angeles office of the FBI leaned over the counter and pressed his ear to a headset.
"It's his second trip to the bank," the technician said.
There was a weekly meeting with the bureau chief in a few minutes, and this would give Carson something to talk about. He went to the computer room and requested a profile on Vincente Calabrese. He was second in line, he noticed. An LAPD detective named Rivera had gotten in ahead of him. He called Rivera.
"This is Tom Carson over at the FBI," he said.
"Hi." An unenthusiastic response. Why did cops hate the FBI so much? He had never understood it.
"I just ran a guy named Vincente Calabrese through the system, and I saw you did, too.
What have you got?"
"His fingerprints were on a car used in a crime. Mob hood stole a car and ran a guy down with it. Contract job. Calabrese's prints were on the dashboard."
"And what do you surmise from that?"
"I surmise he was in the car. A witness said there was a second man."
"Where do you go from here?"
"Nowhere," Rivera replied. "The guy's a complete zero in the system. No paper of any kind.
All I can do is put a flag on his record and wait for him to get arrested. It'll happen sooner or later. It always does."
"Right, Detective Rivera," Carson said.
"Thanks for your help."
"Hey, wait a minute," Rivera said. "I showed you mine, now you show me yours."
"Oh, well, we've got even less than you have," Carson said. He could hear Rivera swearing as he hung up the phone. Carson walked down the hall toward the office that housed his chief.
"What have you got for me, Tom?" the
chief asked.
You'll recall that we've had a tap on the offices of the Kensington Trust since last May."
"No, I don't,"
the chief replied curtly. Carson was going to have to make this good.
"They're an investment bank based in London. We've suspected them for a long time of a major laundering operation. Now we think there's a significant connection with La Casa Nostra."
"Oh? Well, tell me about it."
"A few months ago, a new face turned up at Kensington's offices, the name of Calabrese. He specifically requested that his money go, and I quote, on the street. He said he expected a return of 3% a week."
"Well, that sounds like loan sharking," the chief said. "Did you run him through the system?"
"Yes, but it's a low-grade presence. Calabrese's prints turned up on a car that had been used in a hit-and-run murder. There's no paper at all on Calabrese."
"Well, then he's mob," the chief said, excited now. "Add Calabrese to the watch list."
"Yes, sir."
Ever since the divorce, over a year ago, Detective Ricardo Rivera had had no money. Cindy got the house and the station wagon, but he was making the payments on both, of course. Then they'd accumulated some savings, but the judge had given her most of it. He knew Cindy well. If he didn't keep up payments, she'd go for sole custody of the boy, and she'd probably get it, too. He sighed heavily. His life was in the toilet, and he didn't like the swim. Rivera arrived at his desk early. There was a message to call Chico. He walked over there instead. Chico was bent over a photographic negative of a thumbprint, inspecting it carefully with a magnifying glass. Rivera waited until he straightened up to speak.
"You got something for me?"
Rivera asked.
"Yeah, sorry I took so long."
"That's okay. It's off the books anyway. I'm just satisfying my own curiosity."
Chico poked through a drawer and came up with a plastic Ziploc bag containing an elongated silver object. There was a fingerprint card taped to it.
"I got a match on the right index," he said. "That what you wanted?" "Well, it confirms my guess," Rivera replied wearily. "But I can't prove when the prints got where they did."
That's the way it goes,
Chico said, handing him the bag. Rivera accepted it.
Thanks, amigo.
He walked back to his desk, and his heart was beating faster. He had the son of a bitch. He had him cold. If he played his cards right, there was light at the end of his own particular tunnel. Rivera dialed the number.
This is Detective Rivera, he said. I'd like to see him as soon as possible.
Please hold, the woman said.
Michael, that Detective Rivera is on the phone again. He wants to see you as soon as possible.
Michael thought for a moment. Margot, he said, remember when I lost my letter opener a while back? Where did you find it?
I didn't. I just went over to Supply and got you a new one.
I see, he said.
Ask Rivera if he's free for lunch.
Michael got to the beach half an hour early. He parked at the extreme northern end of the parking lot. A couple of hundred yards north was a concrete building containing toilets. He walked over to it and checked the men's room. 3 urinals, 2 stalls, and a sink. He reached behind him and made the pistol stuck in his belt more comfortable. Then he returned to the parking lot. Rivera was on time.
Let's take a stroll while we talk, Michael said.
He started up the beach toward the toilets.
Made any progress on your case? Michael asked. Funny you should ask, Rivera said. It's solved. I wrapped it up this morning.
Michael felt nauseous. Rivera stopped and turned toward Michael.
I think I know where to put my hands on him.
Michael took him by the arm and propelled him gently forward.
I've got to take a leak, he said.
Rivera began walking.
All I've got to do, see, is pick this guy up, fingerprint him, put him in a lineup. I'll have firm fingerprint evidence and 2 eyewitnesses. Bingo. A first-degree murder conviction.
Michael walked into the toilet and stood at a urinal. Rivera did the same. This was reckless, Michael knew, but there was no other way. His right hand went to the small of his back. There was a scraping noise, and a man and a small boy entered. Michael pretended to be stuffing in his shirt tail. What was he going to do now? He started back toward the parking lot.
So, I've got my man, Rivera said. You think there's a movie in this?
Maybe, Michael said.
I've always been interested in the movie business, Rivera said. Production, development, that sort of thing.
Well, Rick, there's always room in the movie business for fresh talent.
I thought there might be, Michael,
Rivera replied. I'm going to need a production assistant and maybe an associate producer, Michael said.
Is that an offer? Rivera asked.
I'd have to be sure of what I'm getting, Michael replied.
Hey, you'd have my personal guarantee, Rivera said.
Yeah, but how can you guarantee such a thing?
Well, you see, my partner is on his 2-week vacation, so I've developed this evidence on my own.
Rick, I think you might be very useful to me. Why don't you come to work for me as an associate producer? How about $100,000 a year?
How about 150?
You drive a hard bargain. When can you come to work?
I'll put in my retirement papers as soon as we've signed a contract, Rivera said.
I'll get something drawn up today, Michael said.
That sounds good,
Rivera said, sticking out his hand.
As Claude Rains said to Bogart, I think this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Michael took the hand. I certainly hope so, he said. Right up until the moment I see you dead, he thought. Michael shifted the Porsche down into second gear and turned onto Stone Canyon. He glanced at Vanessa, who sat silently in the passenger seat. Look, this is supposed to be a celebration tonight. Do you think you could try and cheer up a little?
Some celebration, Vanessa said sullenly.
Downtown Nights got a nomination for Best Picture, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, and so did Carol Giraldi. In my role, I could have had that nomination.
Are you blaming me for that? It was Chuck who dumped you from the part.
Well, that's not the way I hear it, she said through clenched teeth. In fact, I hear it quite differently. I just happened to run into Chuck at the Bistro Garden.
Chuck, great. The idiot has blown $750,000 since we made the picture, and he's turned himself into a junkie.
He's looking very well, as it happens. He's just out of rehab and seems very together.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
You didn't tell me you bought his screenplay.
I haven't told anybody. I'm still working on it.
He also told about how you brought Carol Giraldi into the movie and how I got dumped.
Michael slammed on the brakes and brought the car screeching to a halt. He reached over, took her by the shoulders, and turned her toward him.
Listen to me, he said. I've given you the role of a lifetime in Pacific Afternoons, playing opposite one of the biggest stars in the world. I've done this on nothing more than instinct that you'll make a fine actress, and because I love you. What I'm getting back is that you're angry at me because a director dropped you from a part you weren't really suited for.
Vanessa said nothing.
There's the door. Either get out and go your own way or close it and apologize to me.
Vanessa pulled the door closed. She turned back to him, snaked an arm around his neck, and kissed him.
I'm sorry, Michael, she said.
How sorry? This was an old game with them.
She unzipped his trousers and pulled him free. Her head went down into his lap, and her lips closed over him. She moved her head up and down, making little noises.
Michael came violently, but she held on to him, sucking, kissing, stroking, until his spasms ceased.
She tucked him back into his trousers and zipped him up. He put the car in gear and drove up Stone Canyon toward the Goldman house.
They were greeted at the door by an English butler.
Everyone's out around the pool, sir, the man said.
They followed the music outdoors and joined a crowd. Amanda Goldman broke away from a group, hugged Vanessa, and planted a firm kiss on the corner of Michael's lips. Vanessa saw one of her girlfriends and wandered off. Amanda took Michael's arm.
I've never shown you the wine cellar, have I?
She towed him quickly down a narrow flight of steps. The walls were stacked with rows of bottles.
Amanda, this is very impressive, but what the hell are we doing down here?
Every time you're around, all I can think about is getting you into bed, she said.
Now, Amanda, he said, don't you think that would be a little dangerous? After all, I work for your husband.
Let's get something straight, she said. I have no interest in leaving Leo for you, so you're not under any pressure. All I want is to be fucked crazy now and then.
I like the idea, I must admit. I like the terms.
Don't call me. I'll call you, Amanda said.
She turned to the rack behind her and extracted a bottle.
Here's a little reminder of our bargain, she said.
Chateau Mouton Rothschild, 1961, Michael read from the label. One of Bob Hart's favorites, Leo tells me.
Poor Bob, Amanda said. Can't drink anymore. Leo bought that wine from him, you know.
She took his hand.
Now, let's go socialize before they search the house for us.
Michael walked over to the bench where Leo was sitting.
How goes it, boss?
Leo slapped him on the knee.
First of all, a formal congratulations on your Academy Award nomination.
Michael held up the bottle of wine.
I've already been rewarded by your lovely wife. She showed you the cellar, huh?
I was very impressed. I'll save this bottle for a special occasion.
Listen, kiddo, I think the studio owes you a little reward.
Why don't you find a house for yourself? Something nice.
The studio will buy it, then sell it back to you for 50 cents on the dollar.
Leo, that's very generous.
Call Marie Berman. She's the best real estate lady in town. You can go to 5 million.
You're a prince, Leo.
I'm a king, kiddo. You're a prince.
Michael was already dressed when Vanessa woke up.
It's Saturday, she said. What are you doing?
I've got some things to clear up at the studio before we leave for Carmel tomorrow, he said.
I thought we'd have lunch today, she said, pouting.
No, not today, Vanessa.
Where did you and Amanda disappear to at the party last night?
She wanted to show me Leo's wine cellar.
Did you screw her?
Michael looked at her. In a wine cellar? Vanessa, you're beginning to sound like a wife. He had rejected this option long ago.
What's wrong with that? I want to be a wife. We'd be the golden couple of Hollywood.
Well, we can be that without being married. I'll see you later. She really was beginning to be a pain in the ass. He gave the Porsche to the doorman at the Beverly Hills Hotel and found the coffee shop. Marie Berman was waiting for him.
So, the real estate agent said, you want to see houses in the $4 to $5 million bracket?
Just one. Sift through your mental files and find the best house in town for under $5 million. He followed her car out the Pacific Coast Highway through Malibu. Finally, she turned left and stopped at a security guardhouse. The guard raised a gate and they drove in. She stopped before a very impressive contemporary house. They got out of their cars.
You're in Malibu Colony, she said. This little peninsula contains the biggest and best houses.
Inside, the hallway ran through the house to the beach. On the ground floor, there was a huge living room, kitchen, and dining room, and a large library. How much? Michael asked.
This house cost $7 million to build 3 years ago. The owner was a studio head who got chopped. The market in big houses has gone to hell in this recession. Offer them $4.6 million and a quick closing.
Make the offer, Michael said. I can close immediately. She walked into the kitchen and produced a cellular phone from her handbag. Michael walked around the pool, peeked into the cabana. She came through the sliding doors toward him.
You've got a deal.
I'm delighted to hear it, he said, smiling broadly.
Who's going to decorate it for you?
Who's the best?
James Fallowfield, she said.
Call him for me. Tell him I'll spend $1 million if he's here in an hour. James Fallowfield arrived half an hour later. 6 weeks from now, Michael said, I want to walk in this house and find it furnished to the hilt. I don't want to go shopping for a thing. No problem, Fallowfield said. Any preferences as to style? Rich, elegant, subdued, soft, comfortable furniture. I won't have to get a woman's approval on anything? No, just mine. It was easier this way. He'd surprise Vanessa when Pacific Afternoons wrapped. Fallowfield left, and Michael walked around the house again. Perfect. Michael stood on the beach at Carmel.
I haven't told you this, Elliot Rosen said, but Susan has been at me about the singing scene. Yeah, she really doesn't want to do it.
I know, and nothing you or I can say to her will change her mind, but we are going to shoot it.
I'm worried that her attitude will erode Bob's confidence in his ability to do it.
Well, that can work to our advantage, Elliot. The doctor begins the scene shakily anyway, then gains confidence. Bob can bring it off. I'll see to it. When the crew moved back to L.A., Michael's offices were a hornet's nest of activity. He was working every day in the editing room. The business of making Pacific Afternoons exhilarated him. But when he finally left the studio late in the evenings, he had Vanessa waiting for him at home. She hadn't had a lot to do in the exteriors. Now that the burden of shooting rested as much on her as on Robert Hart, she was nervous, tense, bitchy. Michael had read lines with her for a while, but finally, when her insecurity had driven him nearly mad, he'd hired one of the supporting actresses, an old pro, to work with her, and he took to sleeping in his office. Near the end of shooting, Leo asked Michael to stay behind in the screening room.
Kiddo, Susan Hart came to see me this morning. She really doesn't think Bob can bring off the last scene.
For Christ's sake, Leo, Michael said irritably. I made a deal with her. I told her that if she and Bob weren't entirely happy with the scene, I'd shoot an alternate.
Maybe you ought to just shoot the alternate.
Absolutely no. Leo lit a cigar.
You're going to have to find a way to get past Susan on this, or she's not going to let Bob do the scene.
I'll work on it.
You better, kiddo.
Michael sat in a rehearsal studio and listened to Robert Hart sing Dein ist mein ganzes Herz. Hart sang better than Michael could have hoped. Susan was there, and she motioned Michael outside.
Michael, she said, the scene is driving Bob crazy. You don't see it, but I hear about it when we get home. I won't let him do it, and that's final.
All right, Susan. We wrap the day after tomorrow. I'll cut the scene. We'll shoot the alternate.
Good, she said. When do I see it?
How about 10 o'clock Friday morning, my office?
She gave him a big smile, then walked down the hall toward the ladies' room. Michael watched her go. He was thinking hard. Michael slept in his office again on Thursday night. On Friday morning, he went to his briefcase, found a small bottle of Valium, and shook two into his hand. Reconsidering, he added a third. He found a coffee cup in the wet bar and crushed the pills into a fine powder. He added a few drops of hot water from the tap. Then he poured the liquid into a bar glass. If this didn't work, he'd slug her if he had to. At 9:45, Margot showed Susan Hart into Michael's office. He put her on the sofa and gave her the pages to read. He went to the wet bar.
Something to drink?
All right. I'll have a V8.
He took down the prepared glass, opened the juice can, and poured the contents into the glass, giving it a quick stir with a spoon.
Here you are, he said.
Susan sipped the juice idly and continued to read. Finally, she put down the pages and smiled.
I think it's so much better than the singing scene, don't you?
If you say so, my darling.
Susan yawned.
Sorry, I didn't sleep very well last night.
Relax. I'd like you to read something if you have time.
Sure.
He handed her the screenplay for Inside Straight.
Just read the first act and tell me what you think. If you'll excuse me for a moment, I've got to attend to something.
Go ahead. I'll read it.
She sipped the V8. Michael left the office and closed the door. He waited 10 minutes, then returned. Susan Hart sat on the sofa, her head on her chest, snoring lightly. Michael went to a cupboard, removed a gift-wrapped box, and left. He walked quickly down the street to the bungalow occupied by Robert Hart as a dressing room. He knocked and was invited to enter. He held out the package.
This was on your doorstep.
Who from? Hart asked, accepting the package.
I don't know. Go ahead and open it.
Where's Susan?
He tore away the ribbon and wrapping, then opened the box. She's in my office reading a script.
The actor looked into the box and gave a little gasp.
Jesus H. Christ.
He held up a bottle of wine.
It's a Chateau Mouton Rothschild 1961.
I've certainly never tasted anything like that, Michael said.
Hart removed two glasses and a corkscrew from the gift box.
Have some right now, he said. Taste it for me.
Hart poured a glass and sniffed it deeply.
Magnificent nose, he said.
He handed the glass to Michael. Michael sipped the wine.
My God, he said.
Is it truly wonderful? Hart asked.
You know, Bob, Michael said. In this scene, the doctor is supposed to have had a couple of glasses of wine.
I'm on the wagon, Hart said regretfully.
Of course, Michael said.
Still, if it would help the scene, I don't suppose half a glass would hurt.
Michael filled the second glass.
I don't see how it could possibly hurt, he echoed.
Hart sniffed the glass again, then took a sip, sloshing it around in his mouth.
Perfectly wonderful, he pronounced.
He drank from his glass, and Michael refilled it.
Ah, Hart breathed. You know, Michael, I had been more worried about the singing scene than I may have let on.
Oh? Well, it certainly never showed.
Well, nothing to worry about now. I know, but I really would have liked to see it on film. I mean, I wouldn't have liked for anyone else to see it, but I would have found it interesting.
Michael walked onto the set with Bob Hart and called Elliot Rosenova.
Do one quick take of the alternate, he said. No more.
They went through the scene. The doctor interrupted a recital with Vanessa at the piano and made his speech to her.
Cut!
Elliot called.
That's all we need.
There was a buzz as the actors rose from their seats. Michael walked onto the set.
Just a minute, everybody.
He turned to Hart.
Bob, I wonder, just as a little treat for us all, if you'd sing Dein ist mein ganzes Herz for us.
Yes, yes,
some of the supporting cast cried. Hart, who was showing a little pink under his makeup, looked around as if to see if his wife was present.
Well, all right, I'd love to. Just give me a moment.
He walked out of the lighted area. Michael was waiting for him. He handed the actor a glass of wine, then raised his own.
Your good health.
Thank you, Michael,
Hart said, raising his own glass. He emptied it, then turned back to the set. Michael looked at Elliot Rosen, who nodded. All three cameras were trained on Hart.
Just for fun. Let's shoot it, Michael said.
Whatever you say, Hart replied.
Hart, as the doctor, played the scene expansively, singing his heart out. As the song drew to a close, tears could be seen running down his cheeks. The little audience burst into spontaneous applause. Michael separated Bob Hart from the little throng of actors and walked him toward his dressing room. Bob, he said, I only wish your public could have seen that scene.
I only wish Susan could have seen it, the actor replied. But don't tell her I did it.
Don't worry, Bob. Mum's the word.
Michael left Hart and began walking toward his car. As he got into the car, he glanced back and saw Vanessa knocking at Hart's dressing room. Hart opened the door, and she went inside. Michael drove back to his office in a quiet fury. Michael watched as Bob Hart leaned over his wife and kissed her on the lips.
Come on, sleeping beauty, wake up.
Susan Hart opened her eyes.
Is it time to shoot?
We've already done it,
the actor said. She looked at Michael.
Why didn't you wake me?
You were exhausted. I didn't have the heart.
Susan suddenly looked sharply at her husband.
Bob, have you been drinking?
Well, just a glass of wine, the actor replied. A fan sent a bottle.
You shouldn't have, she said worriedly. It's all right. Come on, let's go home.
Michael saw them to their car. When he got back, the phone rang.
Michael, Margot said. It's James Fallowfield. Will you speak to him?
Yes. Michael was excited about the designer's call. After weeks of looking at photographs of furnishings, of approving fabric and paint samples, the new house was approaching completion.
James, how are you?
I'm extremely well, Michael. It's finished. When do you want to see it?
I can be there in an hour.
Michael hung up and walked out of his office. He handed Margot a key.
Margot, I'd like you to find a couple of men and a van on the lot. Then go over to my apartment and remove my clothes. Take them to the new house.
Shall I move Vanessa's things, too?
No.
Margot looked surprised.
As you wish.
As he drove toward Malibu, Michael felt the same thrill of anticipation that he had felt when he was on his way to L.A. for the first time. The designer met him in the hall and walked him through the house. Everywhere there was handsome, comfortable furniture, plus rugs, good pictures.
It's absolutely wonderful, James, Michael said. He walked the man to the front door.
Thank you so much, he said.
There's champagne in the fridge, Fallowfield said, and then left.
As Michael was about to close the door, a van pulled up, followed by Margot's BMW. Michael showed the men where to put his clothes, then came back downstairs.
He found Margot standing in the study, staring.
"It's very beautiful," she said. "In a strange sort of way, Fallowfield has made the place like you."
Michael liked that. "Excuse me, I have to make a call," he said. "Don't leave." He dialed the studio. Vanessa's voice was tired, but happy.
"Hello, Michael. Where are you?"
"I had to leave the studio. You've done a good job, Vanessa. You'll get a lot of offers when the film starts to screen."
"Michael, you sound funny."
"It's time for you to do Hollywood on your own, my dear."
"What?"
"I've moved out of the apartment."
"Michael, I don't understand."
"You and I don't need each other anymore. You'll do just fine on your own."
"Michael..."
"The lease on the apartment has another 6 weeks to run. That'll give you time to find a new place. I'm doubling your salary under our contract. If you need anything, call Margot."
"Michael..."
"Goodbye, Vanessa." He hung up. When he turned, Margot was staring at him oddly.
"Well, that was very strange," she said.
"Will you join me for dinner?" he asked.
"Michael, what exactly does this invitation mean?"
"Nothing profound. Just a good dinner and an evening of uninhibited sex between two people who know each other well." She smiled.
"In that case, I'd be happy to accept."
Michael arrived at his offices at 9 o'clock sharp on Monday morning. He buzzed Margot. "We're screening The Rough Cut at 11. I want you to round up enough people to fill the room. Go heavy on the secretaries. And get the Harts for me." Susan Hart sounded tired.
"Hello, Michael."
"Morning, Sue. Can you and Bob make a screening of The Rough Cut at 11?
"Bob's, not very well," she said. "I'll be there, though."
"Susan, is there something wrong?"
"Didn't you know about Bob's, problem?"
"I'm sorry?"
"Bob can't handle alcohol. He's been on the wagon for months."
"Yeah, he did say that, but I didn't infer that he had a problem."
"All right. I'll see you at 11.
Michael picked up Leo at his office and walked him to the screening room. Margot had done her job well. The room was packed. Michael looked around for Susan Hart. Then he saw her in the fourth row, where Leo liked to sit. "Leo," he whispered, "if Susan tries to talk before it's over, shut her up, will you?" Michael stood against the wall for most of the film's running time. He knew from the faces that he'd made a good film. What he didn't know was if he had been crazy to force a big-time movie star to do a scene that might make laughing stocks of them all. As the scene began, Susan Hart looked over at him with an expression of pure hatred. She whispered something to Leo and started to get up. Leo put his hand on her arm and pressed her back into the seat, a finger to his lips. On the screen, Robert Hart began to sing. Michael looked up the rows of viewers, mostly women, and watched their faces as Bob sang. There was a look of pure wonder on each of them. But Michael's great surprise was Leo Goldman as Hart finished his song. Leo's face was shiny with tears. As the screen went dark, the audience stood and applauded. Finally, only Michael, Leo, Susan, and Elliot were left in the screening room.
"Michael," Susan Hart said, "I want to see the alternate scene."
"I burned the negative this morning." She turned to Leo.
"Are you going to let him get away with this?"
"Susan," Leo said, "didn't you hear the reaction of those women?"
"Well, Michael packed the screening."
"So what? Those secretaries are people. They go to the movies."
"I've been tricked," Susan said. "I don't know quite how it was done, but I won't be made a fool of."
Leo put his arm around her shoulders. "Susan," he said firmly. "Thank Michael." From an article in Vanity Fair,
As Academy Award time approaches again, more than a little attention is being paid to a little film and its rather mysterious producer, Michael Vincent. The film, Pacific Afternoons, has received 4 nominations for Best Picture, Best Actress, and Best Screenplay adapted from another medium. Michael Vincent arrived in Hollywood a couple of years ago with only one movie under his belt, the much-lauded Downtown Nights, which was nominated for Best Picture but didn't win. The late Carol Giraldi won a posthumous Oscar for Best Actress. Downtown Nights was written and directed by Chuck Parrish, but it was the film producer who has, unaccountably, received all the praise. Vincent is currently shooting Inside Straight, another screenplay by Parrish. His next project is said to be a cop drama brought to him by an ex-homicide detective who is now an associate producer with Vincent. This time, Vincent is directing. Vincent is adept at shooting on a shoestring. His secret seems to be to get good people to work for very little. Another way Vincent is able to keep costs down is by using unknown talent. He picked Elliot Rosen, the director of Afternoons, right out of UCLA Film School. And Vanessa Parks, the beautiful young actress who has been nominated for her work in the film, was a little-known model when Vincent met her. He moved her into a Century City penthouse with him. So it would seem that everybody is delighted with Michael Vincent, except that isn't the case. It seems that almost everybody who works with Vincent does well out of it in one way, but loses out in another. Vincent also seems to leave human wreckage in his wake. Carol Giraldi is now dead. Robert Hart, who had been on the wagon, was back at the Betty Ford Clinic 3 days after completing his outstanding work on Afternoons. Vanessa Parks is another such case. She has the fastest developing career of any actress since Julia Roberts, but Vincent stands to gain the most from her success. He owns her contract and negotiates all her deals. Parks is now back with Chuck Parrish, who was her boyfriend when she met Vincent. Vincent is happy to give interviews to the press on the condition that no photographs are taken of him, his office, or his house, and that there be no discussion of his personal life. When one looks into Vincent's background independently, one finds nothing. A blank. So the mysterious Mr. Vincent lives silently in his Malibu colony mansion, practically a gift from Centurion. The only person in whom he seems to confide even a little is his executive assistant, Margot Gladstone, a beautiful 50-ish former actress. Leo Goldman and Centurion are deliriously happy with Michael Vincent. The total grosses on his 2 completed films are over $100 million on an investment of less than $35 million. Recently, Goldman invited Vincent to join Centurion's board of directors. So the mysterious Vincent sails on toward major Hollywood success, and who cares about the jetsam left in his wake? Granted, it's an industry of sharks, but Michael Vincent is, even in Hollywood, something special. Michael put down the magazine and stared out at the sea. He could not put down the fear inside him. They had been checking out his background, and that was very frightening. If anybody smart ever had a reason to find out about him, the truth would eventually be known. The phone rang, startling him. Only a handful of people had his home number.
"Hiya, kid," Leo said. "I trust you will show up for the board meeting at 2.
"I'll be there, Leo. What am I supposed to do?"
"Just agree with me, kid. Vote my way."
"Is there something to vote on today?"
"You'll hear about it at 2. See ya."
Almost immediately, the phone rang again. It was the special ring that identified a call from the front gate.
"There's a lady here to see you," the guard said. "She said to tell you, Amanda."
"Send her in." The front bell rang, and he went to the door.
"Good morning, sir," Amanda Goldman said. "Is it too early for deliveries?"
"Deliver yourself inside," Michael said, smiling and kissing her softly.
"Show me your house," she said.
Michael led her around the ground floor, down to the screening room, out to the pool and tennis court.
"Now show me upstairs," she said.
When he showed her the upstairs deck with the hot tub, her eyes brightened. She undid something, and her little silk dress fell around her feet. She was wearing nothing underneath.
"Join me?"
she asked, stepping into the hot tub. Michael joined her. The board of directors of Centurion Studios convened a little after 2. Leo remained standing.
Gentlemen, I have called this meeting to consider a takeover offer. The offer comes from the Yamamoto Corporation of Tokyo.
He mentioned a very large figure.
If they're offering that, they'll offer more,
Harry Johnson said from the other end of the table.
I move we tell them to stick their offer.
There is a motion on the table to decline the offer, Leo said. Do I hear a second?
Second, a voice said. All in favor?
Leo said. There was a chorus of eyes.
All opposed?
Silence.
Harry's motion is carried unanimously, Leo said.
Leo, Harry said, just because I don't like their offer doesn't mean I couldn't be persuaded to like the right number.
Harry, Leo said, I want you to know that I will never accept an offer from a Japanese company. Centurion is just not for sale.
Everything's for sale, Leo, Harry said. Even Centurion.
Not as long as I control 54% of the voting shares, Leo said. Now, gentlemen, we are adjourned.
10 minutes later, Michael was alone with Leo.
Tell me something, Leo, he said. Those men have come from all over the country for this meeting. I know you must have a good reason, but if I were one of them, summoned out here for a 5-minute board meeting, I would be pissed off.
I do have a reason, Leo admitted. I wanted my board to know that I am not going to brook any leaning toward accepting such an offer.
Why not?
Because this studio is me. It is my life. It's what I do. And who I am. I say.
Michael was spending one of his rare days at the office, working through a pile of phone messages and mail. The phone buzzed.
Rick would like to see you, Margot said. He says it's important.
He sighed.
Send him in.
Rivera was a pain in the ass. Rick came in and closed the door, then sat down.
I got this call over the weekend, he said.
Yes? Michael asked irritably.
From an FBI agent in the L.A. office.
Now Michael was worried, but he tried not to show it.
And? This agent says he did a record search on a guy named Calabrese, and he found out that I had done the same a while back.
Well, why would he do that? Michael asked, alarmed now.
He wouldn't say exactly.
Come on, Rick, don't string this out. What do you think the guy has got?
Well, I happen to know that this particular agent runs the wiretap operation in the L.A. office, Rick said. I think he might have picked up the Calabrese name that way.
What else? Michael asked.
That was it, Rivera replied.
Fine. Don't worry about it. I've got some calls to make, Rick.
Michael, I was wondering, you're going into production on my movie pretty soon. Doesn't that rate a raise?
Listen to me, Rick. I paid you a lot of money, and you come up with exactly one treatment.
Listen, Michael, I didn't mean...
Sure you did, Rick. You thought you could hold me up for even more money, didn't you? Well, if you want to keep making what you're making, you'd better start coming up with some filmable ideas.
Yeah, sure, Michael, I'll get right on it.
And if you hear from this FBI agent again, I want to hear the conversation. Put a recorder on your phone.
Sure, Michael, right away.
Rivera backed out and closed the door. Michael sat and thought. He knew there was only one place he'd ever used the name Calabrese in L.A. He left the office, got into his car, and drove until he found a working payphone. He looked up a number in his pocket address book and dialed. The phone was answered by a beeping noise. "Message for Mr. T," he said. "Call V tonight from a good phone." He hung up, got into his car, and drove back to the studio. Michael stood at the front door and watched the stretch limousine follow the road from the security gate to his driveway. The car stopped, and the chauffeur leapt out and held the door for Tommy Pro, followed by a blonde. Michael met them on the walk and hugged Tommy. Tommy turned and introduced the blonde.
This is Sheila.
Hi, Sheila, Michael said.
Hello,
the girl said. She was nervous and looked a little sick. I thought you'd enjoy staying with me, Michael said, starting the tour of the house.
Tommy, Sheila whispered.
Oh, yeah, Tommy said. Vinny, did a messenger bring a package for me? Right here, Michael replied, reaching for a fat brown envelope on a hall table.
Tommy took the package and held it out toward the girl.
Don't overdo it, he said. We're going to the Academy Awards, and you're not going to be stoned out of your tiny mind.
I won't, Tommy, she said meekly, and trotted toward the guest house after the chauffeur.
Tommy shook his head and laughed.
Junkies gotta have their junk.
Is she gonna be okay, Tommy? Michael asked.
Sure. She'll be fine when she's fixed.
Tell me how it's going in New York, Michael said.
The Don is very, very happy with me these days.
And how is the Don?
Ailing. His liver. He always drank too much.
And what happens when he goes?
I happen.
Hey, that sounds great.
Tommy leaned forward.
Listen, I'm so proud of you, kid. You're doing just great. I read about you all the time.
You saw the Vanity Fair piece?
Yeah, that was a little rough.
Things are quieting down. I gave $250,000 to an industry AIDS charity.
You gave away $250,000?
A cheap investment. Now I'm known in the business as a philanthropist. I've made nearly $15 million on 3 movies, and there's more to come.
How much of it you got left?
Well, after taxes, maybe $4 million in the market, besides what's on the street.
Taxes, Tommy said, shaking his head. Imagine you and me paying taxes.
You too?
Listen, I got a very nice line of legitimate stuff now, Tommy said. I'm always looking for an investment. In fact, some friends of mine have brought up the subject of Centurion Studios.
Michael nearly dropped his drink. Centurion?
Yes, sir. I made some contacts in Japan. They got their own little La Casa Nostra over there, only they call it the Yakuza. And just between you and me, they got Yamamoto sewed up tight.
Yeah?
They think there's a lot of money to be made in the movie business, Tommy said. And you're on the Centurion board.
Went to my first board meeting the other day.
And?
Leo Goldman let the board know that he would never sell. He owns 54% of the voting stock, you know.
Tony smiled slightly.
Not owns. Controls. Big difference.
He got up.
We'll talk some more about this later.
Michael was picked up by a studio limousine in the afternoon and driven to the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion for the Academy Awards. Michael sat with Leo and Amanda. He looked to his right and saw Vanessa Parks and Chuck Parrish sitting directly across the aisle. He nodded, but both of them ignored him.
Michael's mind ran from his banking relationship with the Kensington Trust to Tommy Pro's surprise announcement of his involvement with the Japanese bidding for Centurion. He was startled from his reverie by the reading of Vanessa's name. There was the usual business with the envelopes, and another actress's name was read out. He glanced across the aisle at Vanessa and saw her pale and rigid, clapping noiselessly for the winner. As soon as the winning actress had made her speech, Vanessa and Chuck got up and left. Graceless, Michael thought. More hilarity from the MC. Then the award for Best Actor was announced. A willowy actress read, "And the winner is Robert Hart for Pacific Afternoons." Hart made his way down the aisle and up to the podium.
"Well, first of all, I must thank my wife, Susan," the actor said. Then Hart ran down a long list of names. "Finally," he said, "I must thank the man without whose foresight and wise guidance Pacific Afternoons could not have been made." He drew a breath. Michael suddenly felt all warm inside. He was smiling in spite of himself.
"Leo Goldman," Hart said. Michael was stunned.
"That was a shitty thing to do," Leo said.
Michael's impulse was to flee the theater, but he calmed himself and waited.
Finally,
finally, the award for Best Picture was up. Pacific Afternoons, producer Michael Vincent, someone said. Michael stood, dazed, and a shove from Amanda started him down the aisle. The applause died down as he stepped to the podium and cleared his throat.
I've already thanked repeatedly everyone associated with the marvelous experience that was Pacific Afternoons, so it only remains to thank all of you for conferring this award. Good night.
Someone took his elbow and guided him off stage. There was no point in returning to his seat since the Best Picture Award ended the ceremonies. He spotted an exit sign and headed for it, but someone took his arm and pulled him into the stage manager's office.
Mr. Vincent, I am Special Agent Thomas Carson of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
He nodded at another man.
This is Special Agent Warren. We'd like to talk to you.
Well, what the hell is this? Michael asked angrily.
Perhaps I should say Vincente Calabrese. That's your real name, isn't it? The agent asked.
My name is Michael Vincent, and I resent this intrusion.
Are you refusing to talk to us? The agent said.
I most certainly am, Michael replied. If you wish to speak to me, you may call my office during business hours.
Perhaps you'd rather come down to our offices to talk.
Am I under arrest or something? Michael demanded.
Not exactly.
Then get the hell out of my way, Michael said, brushing past the two men. Outside there was a sea of limousines. Michael spotted his chauffeur.
Take me home, he said. Don't you want to go to the Lazar party at Spargo?
Michael hesitated. If he didn't show for the party, the papers would be full of it the next morning.
All right, take me to Spargo.
He sank into the seat. Michael was home before midnight. He had barely managed to be civil at the Lazar's party. His mind had been racing the whole time, working on the FBI angle. They knew his real name, and they knew that Rick Rivera knew his name. They must also know why Rick knew it. He did not have much time. Michael walked to the guest house, knocked on the door, and entered. Tommy and Sheila were still out. He grabbed the brown envelope. He went to the kitchen, rummaged around until he found some plastic freezer bags, then took two of them out on the beach. He put one inside the other and filled it with sand. Back in the house, he rolled the bag into a sausage shape and taped it closed. Under the sink, he found a pair of rubber kitchen gloves and put them into his pocket. He drove into L.A., exiting at sunset. The block was dark and quiet as he drove past the address and parked. He walked back to the house. He rang the bell. A moment later, a bleary-eyed Rick Rivera opened the door.
Michael! What the hell?
I need to talk to you, Rick. Are you alone?
Absolutely.
I heard from the FBI tonight at the Academy Awards. What do they got on me, Rick?
I told you, I think they picked you up on a wiretap. They asked me why I'd run a check on Calabrese.
And what did you tell them?
I told them I had found the Calabrese prints on the car that ran down the lawyer.
Rick, you said you took the fingerprint evidence with you when you left the force. Is that right?
That's right.
And where is the evidence now?
I told you, it's with my lawyer.
I see. Michael walked over to the door and opened it. Come over here. There's something I want you to see. Rivera walked to the open door and peered out.
What?
Michael took a good backswing and caught Rick across the back of the neck with his homemade cosh. Rick's knees buckled and he fell in a heap. Michael dragged him away from the door. He carried him to the bedroom and dumped him on the bed. He stripped off Rivera's bathrobe, leaving him dressed only in jockey shorts. Then he tucked the man into bed. He removed Sheila's brown envelope from his pocket and donned the rubber kitchen gloves. Two pharmaceutical vials of morphine were inside, along with syringes and a light rubber hose. Michael filled a syringe with morphine, then stood behind Rivera, winding the rubber hose around his arm from the same direction that Rivera would have done. Rivera jerked and opened his eyes, staring at Michael. Quickly, Michael inserted the needle into the vein and emptied it. Michael left the needle in the vein, took Rivera's other hand, and put his fingerprints on the syringe. he began a systematic search of the house. After 10 minutes, Michael got lucky. In a small desk in the den, he found an interoffice mail envelope marked LAPD. Inside were 2 fingerprint cards. He closed the drawer and returned to the bedroom. He rearranged Rivera's body to look more natural. Then, looking up and down the empty street, Michael closed the door behind him. He drove to the house. Inside, he went to the kitchen, replaced the rubber gloves under the sink, and found a packet of matches. He walked out and along the beach, emptying sand from the plastic freezer bag as he went. He walked to the water's edge, struck a match, and lit the police envelope. When it was down to ashes, he dropped it into the water. Michael walked back to the house. As he was about to go upstairs, Tommy let himself into the house with his key, Sheila trailing him. "Tommy," Michael said, "I'm afraid I borrowed Sheila's stash. A friend was in need."
"No sweat, paisant," Tommy said.
"I'm bushed, Tommy. Let's talk in the morning." Michael had already finished breakfast on the terrace when Tommy came out of the house. "I need your help," Michael said.
"Sure.
2 things. I need an alibi from the time I got home last night a little before 12 until about 2:30. How about you and Sheila?" Tommy shook his head.
"The cops hear my name and they're all over you."
He thought for a moment.
"Here it is. Your house guests were Sheila Smith and Don Tanner from New York."
"Who is Tanner?"
"Straight guy, as far as the cops are concerned. Works for me in a legitimate business."
"Well, that sounds good."
"What else?"
Tommy asked. "Can you get a message to Winfield without the feds overhearing?"
"What's the message?"
"Tell him to pull everything I've got off the street and wire it to his branch in the Cayman Islands."
"Consider it done." "Listen, Vinny, I talked to you yesterday about our thing with the Japs. How would you like to be the head of Centurion?"
"Well, what about Leo's control of the voting stock?"
"Goldman controls less than 10% of the stock personally. His wife is the key. Her old man was into everything, and before he died, he set up a trust for her. That trust owns 45% of Centurion's voting stock."
"Yeah, but Leo controls it."
"Well, here's the thing. There are 3 trustees who control Mrs. Goldman's trust. They appoint a representative who sits on the board and votes the stock. Mrs. Goldman has a big say, too. That's why Leo Goldman is the trust's representative."
Michael nodded. "Go on."
"The guy who heads the trustees is named Norman Geldof. He's an investment banker. He's also into some stuff with us."
"But won't he listen to Amanda Goldman? Won't he consider her wishes?"
"She has to be made to see the light."
Tommy smiled and spread his hands. Michael blinked.
"Tommy, you're getting into the realm of the impossible here." "Not with your talent with women. Jesus, Vinny, I'd be surprised if you weren't banging her already. You start creating a few doubts about how Leo is running the store."
Michael put down his coffee cup. "I've got to get to the office. Will I see you tonight?" Tommy shook his head.
"We're getting a noon plane."
He wrote down Don Tanner's address and phone number.
"He's corporate counsel for a film distribution company."
The 2 men stood up and embraced. It was after lunch before the 2 FBI agents showed up at Centurion Studios. Michael showed them into his office. He wondered if they knew yet that Rivera was dead.
"Where were you between midnight last night and 2 a.m. this morning?"
Carson asked. They knew.
"At home. I went to Irving Lazar's party at Spago, but I was home before midnight."
"Can you support that statement?"
"Of course. I had house guests. They were already home when I got there, and we stayed up talking until about 2:30.
"Who were these guests?"
"Don Tanner,"
A film distributor and his girlfriend, Sheila Smith. Would you like their number?
I would. Michael wrote down Tanner's number on the pad. Carson and Warren stood up.
We'll be back, Carson said. No, you won't, Michael said. Not unless you have a warrant for my arrest.
The two agents left. Michael and Amanda Goldman lay naked on the upstairs back deck of the house. They had already made love once.
If I let myself, I could fall very much in love with you, she said. Hell, maybe I already am.
Amanda, apart from loving me, do you like me? She smiled.
I do.
Do you trust me?
Probably as much as I trust anybody.
Well, then there's something I have to tell you.
What?
There's major trouble brewing at Centurion.
What kind of trouble?
Has Leo told you about the Japanese offer?
Yes. He said it was inadequate.
Suppose they made it good enough. What do you think Leo would do?
I hope he would take it.
Michael shook his head. I think Leo likes running the studios so much that he's too emotionally involved to make a good business decision.
God knows he loves running the studio, she agreed.
There's more to this, Michael said. Leo is getting into a couple of very expensive projects.
Oh, you mean the science fiction film?
Yes. And then there's the Vietnam movie. It would have to be shot in the Philippines, and you know how shaky the political situation is there.
That does sound risky, Amanda said.
I think there's some restiveness among the board members, Michael said, about those two films and the Japanese offer. The potential exists for a major debacle.
I've got to do something, she said.
Well, don't say a word to Leo, whatever you do, Michael said.
I'll keep you posted on developments.
Well, that's very sweet of you, Michael, she said. I know how loyal you are to Leo. I know you would never do anything to hurt him.
Michael sat in Leo's private screening room and watched the studio head's latest personal production, Drive Time, a comedy.
What do you think? Leo asked when the lights came up.
I think it's going to do business, Michael said.
Good, Leo said. I'm getting some flack from Harry Johnson about my personal stuff. Now he's hoping I'll fall flat on my face with the sci-fi movie.
Michael followed Leo into his private office. The storyboards for the science fiction movie were stacked against a sofa. The movie still had no name.
I want your honest opinion, Leo said. If I can make the movie for $80 million,
what do you think it'll do in the U.S.? Believe me when I say it'll do $175 million domestic, Michael said. God only knows what it'll do worldwide.
Leo's eyes lit up.
That's what I think, he said. I'm thinking of putting the Vietnam film in turnaround.
Why?
Well, you know how nuts the Philippines have been politically, Leo said.
It would be worth a little hassle in the Philippines to get a great movie made, Michael said.
Johnson was on the phone this morning about these two films, Leo said.
Fuck 'em, Michael said. Make the movies you want to. Why else be head of a studio?
You're right about that, kid, Leo said with vehemence.
He reached into his top desk drawer and removed a small revolver, gold-plated. He flipped the cylinder open and showed Michael that it was loaded.
You know what I'd do if I had to let somebody like Johnson tell me what movies I could or couldn't make?
He held the pistol to his temple and pulled the trigger. Michael was halfway out of the chair before he realized that the gun had not gone off.
Leo chortled. He tossed the revolver to Michael.
Michael opened the cylinder and extracted a cartridge. It looked real enough, though it felt a little light.
Special effects made them for me years ago. I've got the real ammo, too, he said, holding up a handful of loose cartridges, then dropping them back into the drawer. If ever some nutcase gets through security and into this building, he said.
Leo put the weapon back into the drawer. I'd better get back to my office, Michael said.
Margot gave him his messages.
How did the screening go?
She asked. I thought it was okay. Leo put a gun to his head when it was over. Margot laughed.
The gold-plated one?
That's the one.
He's been doing that for years, every time he wants to make a point.
Michael looked at her. Why don't you come over this weekend and cook you and me dinner?
Why not?
Margot said, smiling. Michael walked into the Beverly Hills Hotel and out into the rear gardens. A housemaid directed him to Bungalow 4. A Japanese answered the door. I am Michael Vincent. Harry Johnson stood up and approached Michael, his hand out.
Hello, Michael, he said. This is Mr. Matsuo Yamamoto.
How do you do,
Mr. Vincent, Yamamoto said. This, Johnson continued, is Norman Geldorf, chairman of Geldorf & Winter Investment Bankers, and this is Mr. Thomas Provenzano, an associate of Mr. Geldorf.
Tommy Pro stuck out his hand.
I'm very glad to meet you, Mr. Vincent.
Michael waited for Johnson to speak.
This meeting was called, Johnson said, so that I could present Mr. Geldorf and Mr. Provenzano with an up-to-date account of the present condition of Centurion.
Is Mr. Yamamoto to be given this information as well?
Now, Michael, Johnson said, Mr. Geldorf and I represent between us voting control of Centurion. We felt it altogether proper for Mr. Yamamoto and his associates to share this information.
Do I have your absolute assurance, Michael asked, that what I say will be held in the strictest confidence?
You do,
Geldorf and Johnson said together.
I have some concerns about the direction the studio is taking, Michael said. The current production schedule contains two projects that are very high budget indeed, and not what I'd consider high quality.
Which are those? Geldorf asked.
Two untitled projects, a science fiction film and one about the Vietnam War.
And what is your opinion of the chances for success of these productions?
I think that both these projects are highly risky at best, Michael replied.
Michael, have you recently attended a screening of a new production called Drive Time?
Yes.
Well, what'd you think of it?
I don't think it'll be a great success.
Well, that was Leo Goldman's personal production, was it not?
Yes.
Mr. Vincent, Geldorf asked, what sorts of films do you believe Centurion should be making at this moment in time?
I'm personally making the kind of movies that I think we should concentrate on, Michael said. Films with low risk and high profitability.
Harry Johnson stood up.
Michael, we are all grateful to you for your candor. Please be assured that your remarks will be held in the strictest confidence.
Michael understood that he was dismissed. An hour later, Michael was parked on a side street when a limousine pulled up next to his car and the rear window slid silently down. Tommy Pro beamed at him.
Aces, Paisan, he said. Now Norman Geldorf will go and see Amanda Goldman.
Good, Michael said.
When does Goldman get back from New York?
Tomorrow afternoon.
Schedule the meeting in his office, okay?
All right, Michael said.
Michael drove back to Centurion. Leo's secretary was sitting at her desk.
Hi, he said. Would you schedule a meeting for me the moment he gets back?
She flipped open a diary.
Four it is.
Michael put a hand on the doorknob of Leo's office.
There's something I left in here yesterday. It's on Leo's desk.
Sure, go ahead, she said.
Michael stepped into Leo Goldman's office and closed the door behind him. Michael looked up into the glazed eyes of Margot Gladstone and gave a little thrust. Margot dissolved into a series of whimpers, climaxing quietly as she always did. He rolled onto her side but remained inside her.
That was a wonderful bit of weekend recreation, Margot said. I lost count of how many times I came.
6 or 7, Michael said.
Stop bragging, she laughed.
I'm hungry.
All right, I'll finish dinner.
When they had finished dining, Michael leaned back in his poolside chair. That was wonderful, he said. What would I do without you?
Funny you should mention that.
What?
Michael, you must remember that when I came to you, I said I was serving out my time until my pension matured.
Vaguely, he replied.
Well, next month, I'm off.
Michael was alarmed. You can't do that, he said. She shrugged.
I was thinking of Mexico.
Michael was genuinely panicked at the thought of losing Margot. She made his life work. She was the closest thing to a confidant he had ever had. Suppose you were doing a different job, he said.
What do you mean?
Michael sat back. He made a decision. All right, I'll tell you. In a day or two, Leo will be out. Her eyes widened. And I'll be running the studio. I met with Harry Johnson and some other people this afternoon.
The Japanese?
Michael nodded, and a friend of mine.
Tommy?
You do keep up, don't you?
I hear more than you think,
Margot said. What do you hear? He asked, a little worried.
I know how much money you have and where it is.
Where is it?
Well, you've moved it out of the Kensington Trust.
Michael was taken aback. What else do you know?
Oh, I've put the pieces together. I know about Calabrese and Moriarty. I'm damn sure you got rid of Rick Rivera.
Well, this is an unexpected turn of events, Michael said.
Oh, Michael, you have nothing to fear from me. I've watched you operate with total admiration. You have the single most important quality a successful producer can possess. You are a complete sociopath.
Michael stared at her silently.
I simply mean that you have no conscience whatever, and that you will do anything necessary to get what you want. If I had met you when I was 25, you and I could have ruled this town together.
We still might, Michael said. How would you like to be chief operating officer of Centurion? Her eyebrows went up.
That's a big leap from executive assistant, she said. But there's a problem here.
Nothing we can't overcome, Michael said.
So you get Leo's job. Then Geldof and Johnson sell out to the Japanese, and suddenly you're not in charge anymore. You'd be working for them, and I don't think you'd like that.
You're right.
So what are you going to do?
Michael smiled. I'm going to take Leo's job.
And then I'm going to fuck the Japanese. And Tommy?
Tommy is my closest friend. He and I can work something out.
Well, if you can do that, I'm with you,
Margot said. Then you're with me. Michael knocked, then opened the door. Leo was sitting at his desk. He looked up.
Hiya, kiddo.
How was your trip?
Pretty damn good. What did you want to see me about?
Before Michael could speak, the door to his office opened. Harry Johnson entered, followed closely by Norman Geldof.
We have to talk, Johnson said.
Sure. Leo waved them to chairs.
Leo, the board is unhappy, Johnson said. We've met in your absence, and we've decided that it's time for you to step down.
What?
Leo demanded.
Board members with a large majority of shares concurred in this decision.
Leo looked at Geldof.
What did Amanda have to say about it?
Geldof looked away.
It's not her decision, as head trustee, it is mine alone.
Leo turned to Michael.
Not a movie maker among them.
How do they expect to run this place without me?
He looked at Johnson.
Or do you just expect to sell the joint to the Japs?
Well, they made us another offer, Johnson said.
So? Why didn't you consult me about it?
Because you made it plain that you wouldn't accept under any circumstances.
Leo stared at him, then reached into his desk drawer and took out his revolver. He put the gun to his head.
If I thought I couldn't run this place better than the bunch of you and the Japanese put together, I'd blow my brains out.
Oh, come on, Leo, Johnson said. Don't start with that old routine.
Leo took the gun away from his head and pointed it at Johnson.
Okay, instead of me, I'll do you.
Leo, stop behaving like a child.
Leo pulled the trigger. The gun went off, and Johnson spun sideways out of his chair. Leo was standing, looking at Johnson, then at the gun, a look of amazement on his face. Michael saw his chance. He stood up, grabbed Leo by the wrist with one hand, then closed his other hand over Leo's, running his finger inside the trigger guard.
"Don't do it, Leo!" Michael shouted. He jerked Leo's hand around toward his head and pressed Leo's trigger finger. The gun roared again.
The bullet entered Leo's head just under the temple and exited above his right eye, spattering Michael with gore.
"Michael, are you shot?"
Geldof yelled. Michael picked up Leo's phone and dialed 911.
"An ambulance," he said to the operator, giving her the address. "There's been a shooting."
He dialed the legal department. "Leo Goldman has just shot another man and himself. Get the best lawyer you can find up to Leo's office at once." Michael and Geldof sat on facing sofas in Leo's office.
"All right, let's go through it once more," a detective said.
"No," Michael replied. "You've heard it again and again.
Surely you don't think that Mr. Vincent and I murdered two men in this office," Geldof said.
The other detective put down the phone.
"There hasn't been a murder," he said. "They're both still alive."
"Well, that's wonderful," Michael managed to say. "How are they?"
"Well, Johnson wasn't hurt bad. The bullet exited the shoulder, broke his collarbone."
"What about Mr. Goldman?" Geldof asked.
"Well, he's alive. That's about it."
The group started to shuffle out of the office, but one detective pulled Michael back.
"My name is Hall. I was Rick Rivera's partner. We met when Rick and I came to see you about the Moriarty murder."
"Oh, yes.
People around you keep dying and getting hurt," Hall said.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Moriarty dies right after you see him. Rick dies after he comes to work for you, and Rick was never a junkie. And now these two."
"That's about enough out of you," Michael said. "You're implying that I had something to do with all these things, and you're wrong. You just do your job, and you'll find out that I'm nothing more than an innocent bystander." Michael turned and stalked out of the room. Michael looked around the hospital room. The entire Centurion Board of Directors was gathered around Harry Johnson's bed.
"Norman, do you have a motion?"
Johnson asked. Geldof nodded.
"I move that the board appoint Michael Vincent as president and chief executive officer of Centurion Pictures."
"Do I hear a second?"
"Second,"
another board member said.
"All in favor?"
"Aye," rumbled the group.
"Opposed?"
Silence.
"Congratulations, Michael,"
Johnson said.
"This meeting is adjourned."
Michael walked down the hall toward Leo Goldman's room.
"Hi, Leo," Michael said softly.
Leo blinked rapidly.
"There was a board meeting. They chose me to succeed you."
Leo blinked rapidly again. Michael leaned over and looked into Leo's good eye.
"Leo," he said, "if you can understand me, blink once."
Leo blinked once.
"I want to ask you some questions. Blink once for yes, twice for no."
Leo blinked once.
"Leo, do you want to go on living like this?"
Leo blinked twice.
Do you want me to do something about it?
Leo blinked once. Gently, Michael lifted Leo's head and removed the pillow. He leaned over Leo.
Is this what you want, Leo?
Leo blinked once.
Leo, I want to thank you for everything you've done for me.
Leo blinked once.
Goodbye, old friend.
Leo blinked once, and the eye filled. A tear trickled toward his ear. Michael placed the pillow over Leo's face and pressed gently. He waited for 3 minutes, then removed the pillow. He lifted Leo's head and placed the pillow under it. Then he left the room. For the first time since he had been a little boy, Michael was fighting back tears. Amanda Goldman received her husband's friends and admirers at her home. Some 400 people ate, drank, and talked of Leo Goldman. Michael found himself besieged by new admirers. When the crowd began to drift away, Michael cornered Norman Geldorf and Harry Johnson, whose arm was still in its cast.
"I don't think we should sell to the Japanese," he said. "Not yet, anyway."
"I'm inclined to agree," Geldorf said. "With Leo gone, they'll try to knock down the price."
"Give me a chance to get some movies into production," Michael said.
"Then, if selling is the right thing to do, you'll get a lot more money for the studio."
Both men nodded. Near the end of his first week as head of Centurion Pictures, Michael was working at his desk in what had been Leo Goldman's office. Margot Gladstone entered.
"Have you seen the papers?" she asked.
"No."
Margot placed the New York Times on his desk. Michael found the story. Benito Carlucci, for many years head of New York's largest mafia family, died yesterday at the age of 72 of complications of liver disease. Michael dialed the number of a cellular phone.
"Yes?"
Tommy's voice was tense.
"It's Vinny. I'm very sorry, Tommy. I know you loved the old man."
"I did, but he's gone. Now we've got stuff to do."
"When can we get together?"
"I'll try and come out there next month."
"Good." Michael hung up.
"Well," Margot asked, "what's going on?"
"He couldn't really talk," Michael said. "He'll come out here and then we'll know."
Michael called the board meeting to order.
"Good afternoon, gentlemen. This'll be brief. I wish to bring to a vote the employment contracts for myself and Margot Gladstone. Do I hear a motion?"
"Move that the contracts be approved,"
a board member said.
"Second," said another.
"Opposed?"
Silence.
"The motion is carried unanimously," Michael said. "Gentlemen, this meeting is adjourned until the next regular monthly meeting." Michael stepped back into his office where Margot waited for him.
"You are now the chief operating officer of Centurion Pictures," he said.
Margot beamed and kissed him.
"Now," Michael said, "go fire the chief financial officer."
"Yes, sir,"
Margot replied.
At Santa Monica Airport, Michael greeted Tommy Pro with a hug and a kiss at the bottom of the air stairs and hustled him into the Mercedes he had inherited from Leo Goldman. Tommy fiddled with the TV. Tom Brokaw's image appeared on the screen.
"What's going on?" Michael asked. "I'm not learning a hell of a lot from the newspapers."
"Shh," Tommy said, pointing at the TV.
Brokaw was back.
"Early this afternoon, two mafia capos were gunned down in the street as they left a Manhattan restaurant."
"This is why I'm visiting you," Tommy said.
"So who's left?"
Michael asked.
"Who's running things?"
"I'm running things."
Michael leaned back in the seat.
"So, you're the Don."
Tommy grinned.
"I'm the Don."
At sunset, Michael and Tommy strolled along the beach.
"You're a very lucky man, Vinny,"
Tommy said.
How do you mean? If the Don had lived another 24 hours, you'd be dead.
What?
I held him off as long as I could, and he died.
The old man wanted me dead?
You double-crossed him, Vinny. Some people would say that you double-crossed me.
Tommy,
you talked Geldof and Johnson out of selling the studio to the Japs, which means
us and the Japs. Tommy, listen to me. I've got a movie studio in the palm of my hand. Do you know what that means?
Vinny, if it hadn't been for me, you'd be feeding the fishes in the Pacific Ocean right now.
Tommy, I appreciate...
You don't appreciate nothing, Vinny. You suck at the tit and you kick everybody else in the teeth.
Tommy, I owe you. I know that. I'll do anything I can to make it up to you.
You think this movie studio is some kind of toy, don't you? You don't recognize it for what it is, which is a machine for printing money.
Tommy, just tell me what you want.
I want 60% of the stock of Centurion Studios. That's Harry Johnson's stock and Amanda Goldman's, her trust that Norman Geldof runs. I'll get the rest myself.
Tommy, if I talk them into that, I cut my own throat. I won't be in charge anymore. I'll be working for somebody else again, don't you see?
Tommy turned and walked back toward the house.
Michael followed behind.
Michael and Amanda Goldman stood under a hot shower, kissing until the soap had washed away. Then Michael turned the shower off. He stepped out, held a terry robe for her, then found one for himself.
I feel like some eggs, he said. Can I make you some?
Love some. You do that while I dry my hair.
Michael went down to the kitchen and began to work. As Amanda came into the kitchen, he served the bacon, eggs, and muffins.
I thought I would be in some kind of shock for a while, Amanda said. But it's only been 2 weeks since Leo died, and I feel liberated.
Michael took a deep breath.
Listen, we've got some business to talk.
Okay, shoot.
I want you to tell Geldof that you want him to sell all the Centurion stock in the trust account.
She gaped at him. Are you mad? I thought you wanted my backing so you could run the studio.
Believe me, it's just the right time to sell.
Michael, do you remember once when I told you what Leo did for me in our marriage?
I think so.
I said I could have anybody I wanted at my dinner table, remember?
Yes, I remember.
Well, the reason I could do that was because my husband ran a major movie studio.
Yes, but Leo is dead.
But when you and I are married, I want you still to run the studio.
This was the first time marriage had been mentioned, and Michael tried not to look flustered.
No, don't worry, I'll still be running the studio, just under different ownership.
But the only way I can be sure of that is to hang on to my stock.
Amanda, the Japanese have offered me an ironclad contract.
But they can always buy out your contract. It happens all the time in this town.
God damn it, Amanda, just do as I say.
She stood up.
I think you're forgetting who you're talking to, she said, then stalked out of the house.
Michael, wearing only a robe, couldn't chase her. Later in the afternoon, Margot came into his office.
Michael, she said, I've been reading my contract, and I find that I can be fired at any time, for any reason, on 90 days' notice.
Margot, why would I want to fire you?
I know you wouldn't, but suppose something happened to you. I don't want to be in a position where I can get thrown out on my ear.
You mean you don't want to have to rely on my word?
If you want to put it that way, yes.
Your contract remains as it is, he said. If you don't trust me, then go fuck yourself.
Margot turned white.
I'm glad to know where I stand, she said coldly.
Then she walked out of the room. Michael went back to his script, but he had trouble concentrating. Finally, he got up and opened the door that joined their offices.
Margot, he said, I'm sorry,
He looked around the room. She was gone. Michael stood at the mirror and expertly tied his evening tie. The phone rang, the private number only a few people had.
Hello? It's Tommy.
Hey, Tommy, how are you?
Not so good. I just had a drink with Norman Geldof.
And?
He won't sell the trust stock.
I told Amanda Goldman to tell him to sell everything.
She didn't get the message. I don't think you're getting the message either, Vinny.
Look, she'll do whatever I tell her to.
Geldof told me it was her express wish that she hang on to the stock, just so she can keep you in power at the studio.
Tommy.
In fact, Geldof had the distinct impression that you were playing her along, just to get her to do that.
Tommy, that's not so.
Goodbye, Vinny, Tommy said.
Or maybe I should say, goodbye, Michael.
He hung up. Michael crashed the phone down on the receiver.
God damn it, he screamed.
He grabbed his dinner jacket. He was already late for an industry dinner at the Beverly Hills Hotel. At the pre-dinner cocktail party, Margot Gladstone came up as he was talking with an agent and waited until she could catch his eye. He took her arm. Listen, let's talk after this. Come out to the house and...
It's over, she said sharply. The only reason I'm here is to tell you that face to face. My resignation is on your desk.
She pulled her arm away from his grasp.
All bets are off, she said.
Then she smiled.
Goodbye, Michael.
She turned and made her way through the crowd.
Late that night, after the speeches, Michael walked out of the hotel and waited while the Porsche was retrieved from its parking space. He got into the car and started down the drive toward Sunset Boulevard. A red Corvette was overtaking him on the left and crowding him a bit. He gave way a little to let the sports car pass. Then suddenly the Corvette veered sharply to the right as if to ram him. Fortunately, there was a street to his right. He turned the corner, swearing loudly. Directly in his path, two cars were stopped. He stood on the brake and suddenly the Corvette was beside him. Two men got out of the car and walked to either side of the open Porsche. Panicky now, Michael slammed the car into reverse, but a glance in the rearview mirror showed him another car stopped directly behind him.
Put your hands on your head,
a young voice said. An automatic pistol appeared near his head.
Let's have your wallet,
the young voice said. Michael slumped with relief. This was no hit. He'd already be dead if this were a contract job. He handed his wallet to the young man.
Thank you, Vinny, the gunman said.
Startled, Michael looked up.
How do you...
The young man moved the gun from Michael's head, pointed it instead at his lap, and fired twice. Michael screamed. His lower belly was on fire. He grabbed at his crotch, then jerked his hands back. They came away crimson with blood. He was only vaguely aware of the cars roaring away, even less aware of reaching for the car phone, dialing 911. Michael sat at his desk, going over the budget for a film. Margot came through the door from her office.
Time for the screening, she said.
Michael looked up at Margot, elegant as ever. She dressed better on her new salary. She moved behind him.
Shall I?
No, he barked. I'd rather do it myself. He was more and more irritable these days, especially since there was no longer any sex to relax him. Michael grabbed the joystick and reversed. The chair rolled back from the desk. He guided the chair expertly down the little ramp that had been built for him, right into the screening room. Tommy Pro and Mr. Yamamoto turned to watch him enter.
Good morning, Tommy. Mr. Yamamoto.
Michael sat numbly and watched the film, a sorry, violent mess, starring a kung fu expert who until recently had been Tommy Pro's personal trainer. Tommy was looking very fit since he'd moved to L.A. The film ended. Yamamoto was the first to speak.
Very good, he said in his Oxford-accented English.
I'm glad you liked it, Mr. Yamamoto, Michael said.
Michael straightened his desk, then wheeled himself toward the conference room for what would be his last board meeting at Centurion.
Certainly, Michael felt no joy in the fact that he had publicly presided over the studio's rapid decline, that his own name was now synonymous with schlock. He felt no affection for the men and one woman who had sucked the very viscera from the studio that had been the preeminent maker of quality Hollywood films. Still, he felt a certain peace, knowing it was nearly all over. The dozen men and one woman took their places at the table, Tommy Proe at the head, Margot Gladstone to his right.
"This meeting," Tommy said, "will be brief, since there is little business to conduct. We..."
"Mr. Chairman?" Michael asked. Tommy looked irritably in Michael's direction.
"If we could just stick to the agenda," he said.
"Mr. Chairman," Michael continued, "the board is aware that today is our chairman's birthday, and I have been asked to present a small gift."
Tommy smiled. "Well, that is very kind of you, Michael."
"It is well known to all of us that the chairman has a keen interest in the weapons used in Centurion's films," Michael said. "I've asked our special effects department to supply something which will be used in our forthcoming production, Armed Force." Michael released the locks on his briefcase. Inside lay two gleaming automatic weapons. Michael picked up one of the guns and began screwing a suppressor onto its barrel. He passed the weapon down the table to Tommy, who received it gingerly.
"Is it loaded?"
Tommy asked. Michael began screwing the suppressor onto the second weapon.
"Of course, Tommy, but only with ammunition formulated by special effects. I assure you it would be quite safe if you raked the conference table with automatic fire."
Tommy cocked the weapon.
"I hope you won't mind, Michael, if, in light of previous events, I don't point it at anyone."
"Of course," Michael replied.
"Try that beautifully paneled wall. I assure you it will come to no harm."
Everyone stood and backed away from the table as Tommy raised the weapon.
"All right, let's pretend that all the New York film critics are lined up against that wall."
He pointed the machine gun at the wall and pressed the trigger. The weapon exploded in Tommy's face. Pandemonium broke out. Margot Gladstone dragged Tommy away from the table and propped him up against a wall.
"Tommy," she was crying, "are you alive?"
Tommy was indeed alive, though his face was ruined, and he seemed able to make only croaking sounds.
"Thank you for your tender efforts on Tommy's behalf, Margot," Michael said.
Then he fired a short burst in her direction. Margot spun around, bounced off a wall, and fell in a heap before Tommy. Michael swung his weapon toward a group of directors who were now huddled in a corner of the room. He fired a long burst at the group. He swung his wheelchair back toward Tommy. He pointed the weapon. "On behalf of movie lovers everywhere, I give you this," he said. He fired, and Tommy's body did a little dance. Michael was reloading when efforts to break down the door succeeded. He hurried, but was not fast enough. Two uniformed security guards were emptying their weapons in his direction. Michael felt himself fly sideways out of his wheelchair. Footsteps approached his bed. Michael swiveled his eyes to try and see who it was. Amanda Goldman's face moved into his vision.
"Oh, my darling," she said. "You're awake."
She moved a finger back and forth across his field of vision. Michael's eyes followed the finger.
"You really are awake, aren't you? I've been visiting you for weeks, and they've always told me not to expect any response. Something about brain damage."
Michael's eyes widened.
"Can you hear me?" she asked. "If you can, blink once for yes and twice for no."
Michael blinked once.
"I want you to know what's been happening," she said. "A lot of Japanese turned up at the studio, and they've been running things."
Michael closed his eyes.
"My lawyer's got a trust established to run your affairs, and I'm the trustee. Somebody found the will you left, naming me as the beneficiary."
Michael stared at her. "Michael, there's something I want to tell you." Michael blinked once. He was impatient with all this talk. He had to find a way to let her know what he wanted to do. "I've met somebody, and I've been seeing a lot of him. His name is Chuck Parrish." Michael's eyes opened wide again. This is all real incestuous, because until recently he was living with Vanessa, your old flame. She, my darling, is living with Bob Hart. Can you believe it? Michael blinked rapidly. This was insane. "Chuck is sweet," she said. "I knew you'd be glad I was with a friend of yours. I've taken the money in my trust that I got for my Centurion stock and formed a new production company to produce Chuck's work." Amanda was quiet for a moment. Then she wiped a tear from the corner of an eye. "You know why I'm here, don't you?" Michael blinked rapidly. He had to think of some way to communicate what he wanted. "I know what you want, my darling, because you as much as told me when Leo was ill." Michael saw something move into his field of vision, and it was white. "Goodbye, my darling," Amanda said. "I love you." The pillow filled his vision, and then it was dark. Michael couldn't even blink. He fought the pillow with his mind, but it didn't work.
Suddenly, it wasn't dark anymore. There was light coming from somewhere, and miracle of miracles, he could move. He held up a hand to shield his eyes, but then it wasn't necessary. The light was kind, and it seemed to originate down a hallway or tunnel. Michael walked toward it. Then there was a dark shape in the light, another person, and somehow he felt he knew who it was. He walked faster. It was a man, and he was walking toward Michael, his hands reaching out for him. Behind the man were other people. Michael reached out for the man, and then he knew who he was. Onofrio Calabrese took his son's hands and held them tightly. His smile was ghastly.
Michael struggled to free himself, and then other people were around him, pulling him forward into the light. They were glad to see him in some odd way, and he knew them all. There was a woman, and it was Carol Giraldi. She held on to him particularly. Rick Rivera was there, and my God, it was Leo. Leo put an arm around his shoulders and hurried him forward. Benedetto and Cheech walked alongside him, and there, coming out of the light, was the lawyer, Moriarty. Michael felt a terrible fear, and he tried to dig his heels in, but nothing could stop his progress toward the light. Inexorably, they drew him into it. Michael suddenly found that he could do more than walk. He could scream.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.